Lyndon called me from the Texas hotel, and he was still irate. I said, Lyndon, about last night, and he went to cursing. He used foul language all the time, and he said, those Kennedys, he repeated, they will never embarrass me again. That's no threat. That's a promise. And I'd like the entire world to know how I personally feel is the fact Lyndon Johnson knew about the assassination and was a part of it.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 25th of August, 2023, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre with a fantastic exhibition for the next week or so. If you're around in Bristol, if you're anywhere near, open till 6 o'clock during the week and weekends. I think it's all the time. It's open anyway. You could probably check it out on the PRSC website, but it's brilliant. It's just lots of fun. It's also to do with sort of the street protest. And that is here at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol. And we're broadcasting on talkradio.org.uk, stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please, anything but the Google Play Store. There's plenty of other places. If you need somewhere, just go to thisweek.org.uk and there's an alternative Android store there you can use. I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks for turning off the psycho in the corner for a little while that gaslights us with its military-grade propaganda, psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes, cancelling the vote winners like Boris and Trump. At least that's what they're trying to do in conjunction with the Department of Justice in the United States. Interesting, isn't it? I was just thinking about this week. If Boris hadn't kept his mouth shut, he'd probably be being put in jail as well, like Trump is. I mean, okay, so he's got his collar, but he's certainly not doing interviews. And if he had been, ooh, gosh, what would have happened to Boris? He'd have been Trumpized. Anyway, while the big farmers, Matt Hancock and Bill Gates, crimes against humanity is all forgotten because of we've got a new bogeyman, the evil Putin. So the wife-murdering king, accelerationist cults now waging war upon the British people as well as Putin too. So this is what the BBC or normal broadcasters might sound like if they hadn't been occupied by the Zionist lobby, as we were hearing all about last week. Amazing, actually, to see those graphs. It's almost like once you see them, you can't unsee them, about the average wealth of Jewish individuals in Britain being so much higher than those of other faiths and other races generally. But fascinating, really. And apparently Jews are oppressed. Well, of course, both could be true. But anyway, David Miller's analysis of that is like a true fearless sociologist. He's saying, well, look, just look at the figures. That's all. This is a graph helping navigate us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution's Irish Republican Labour activist, joining us in the studio, back from his summer holidays, Martin Summers. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
So this week we're going to be a couple of main features, an exclusive this week, with a trade unionist from the Donbass, and he is going to take us through some of his experience of the Ukrainian who is siding with the Russians rather than with Kiev, and he explains why. And Andrei Kochetov is his name, and he's a trade union leader, 5,000 members of his union over in the Donbass. No one else has got this interview. This is what we do. It's called real journalism. You find someone that no one else has been talking to and just get their perspective, particularly Ukrainians from the Donbass. We're not hearing anything whatsoever from them, are we? You know, people who have been subjected to the coup in 2014 and then the attacks by the army. This is what he said, is that, well, the army appeared, you know. So what we're thinking, this isn't the police, is it? No, it's the army, and they're shooting people. So that's why they've got this problem in Ukraine right now. Interesting to get his perspective on all of that, as well as the assassination of Prigozhin, the Wagner leader. We'll be looking at that in part two as well. And we've got Alex Craner talking about that. But to start with, Martin, I think we start with some of these sort of, I suppose, more prosaic stories, the sort of thing that we're seeing in the press. First of all, this week, we've got the collapse of Wilkinson's in the high streets. Now, most towns, I don't know how many they've got around, probably several hundred outlets around the country, most large towns or medium-sized towns, and certainly all cities have got these Wilkos, haven't they, Wilkinson's. We've got several here in Bristol in outlying major shopping centres, as well as here in the city centre. But it looks like within a week or so, everything will be gone. They've got these closing down sales all going on, and the latest on the fate of it is the owner is making a last ditch attempt to rescue it, but it looks as if it's going to fail. Proposal is Doug Putman could save 350 stores and 10,000 jobs as the union calls for employees to get the assets rather than debtors. So it's the Canadian entrepreneur that owns HMV has put in a last-ditch bid to rescue the discount retailer. It may save 350 stores and 10,000 jobs, but the prospects are, they think, pretty low for this. But anyway, what do you make of the collapse of this big high street shop?
Well, there's two aspects to these things, isn't there? There's the fact that all in-person retail is struggling as a result of the explosion of online shopping, so the footfall isn't the same. And also, of course, the economy is dead in the water in Britain. In Germany, they're already in recession. That's where we're going, and this is the kind of thing that happens in a recession.
It is, isn't it? I think the other aspect is that the unrealistic property prices. Yeah, so that the Wilko is having to pay rents for these properties, which aren't actually realistic and commensurate with the modern world. Maybe 10, 15 years ago, they could make enough money in a shop in order to pay that rent without too much trouble, but the rent has been going up whilst the profits have been going down.
Yeah, well, you can see in China the bankruptcy of the Evergrande, I think it's called. If there is a property collapse in China, and I think it's when rather than if, that will cause a property crash across the planet. And this is where all the quantitative easing has gone into forcing up property prices and therefore rents for shops. And, the consequences of it starting to go down are going to be quite dramatic.
Yeah, I mean, they do have a closing down sales on. There was one in Chepstow yesterday, just popped in to have a look. It was almost like vultures kind of looking over the carcass of a dying animal.
Yeah, and it's probably a canary in the mine, speaking of dying animals. It won't just be Wilko. There's more of this to come, isn't
there? This is a positive thing, though, isn't it? Can you see a positive side in this, in a way?
Well,
For smaller hardware shops and ironmongers and people like that, it's going to be quite good.
I think if Wilko can't make it pay, it's unlikely that they're going to be able to make it pay. So when big stores like that go down, it doesn't mean that there's going to be space for little stores. They're working on even smaller margins.
Well, it doesn't. No, I don't. I disagree, because I think sometimes if you've got an they don't necessarily have, particularly if they own their own property, the overheads, whereas Wilko is what they've come in is with loss leading prices. They've forced lots and lots of small retailers to in that area to shut down. Those that have survived must be thinking, thank God, we've just about managed to make it through, and now Wilko, which we thought we were going to have to close our business because of, is still is about to die. So thank God everyone is going to have to come here and buy their bits and bobs.
Yes, except that nobody's got any money. And that's going to affect everybody.
Yeah, but I think the thing is, ironmongers hardware shops do reasonably well, particularly when the economy's slumping, because people are doing the work themselves rather than paying someone to do it. They're buying the few nuts and bolts or whatever it is, some bits of wood or whatever, that to do the job, and maybe doing, even simple stuff like gardening still gets done, doesn't it?
Yes, but at the same time, you can't expect. At the moment, the Lidl and Aldi are doing really well, and Sainsbury's not so much, because people are all going to cut price shops. That you do get that effect in recessions, but of course it's it, it at the same time, it's going to be difficult for anybody to cover their overheads when nobody's spending any money. You know, I'm not going to go out and buy a new electric drill, am I, when I can't pay my electric bill?
The high street, there's a sort of weird thing about this, in that the high street, as those shops close, most towns in the country, you can see several shops, maybe a lot of shops, maybe all the shops in some parades closing, as we had one parade in here, Bristol, where every shop closed. Those properties then get up for grabs, aren't they? So the property suddenly becomes worthwhile to redevelop as, gosh, maybe flats.
Yes, well, that's what's going to happen because the housing market is relatively buoyant compared to the commercial property market, but even that has started to go down. There's such a lot of tax breaks for people to buy houses, and that's why you know there's no capital gains tax on it and all the rest of it, but nevertheless, and that's why it is the way the British economy functions. House prices rise, people then go out and spend money. That's the only thing that keeps us on the road.
Announced this morning, Clinton Cards closing 25% of their shops 20% of their shops around the country. This is not just Wilko. We're going to see a lot of these, particularly the chains, suffering, because we hear about it when the chains go down. We haven't been really hearing about it when two retailers go down. The pubs have also been shutting, haven't they?
Well, that's right. I mean, Germany has gone through two successive quarters of negative growth, which is a recession. And of course, it's not just going to be a recession.
Is that caused by Brexit?
It's caused by the
Britain buying less stuff from Germany.
Well, yeah, but if Germany does go, and the Eurozone does go down the drain, that won't do us any good here in Britain. We will be sucked into that black hole. And the black hole is caused by the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and the refusal to negotiate with the Russians about cheap oil and gas, which, of course, is the basis of the German economy. And, of course, we are part of the Eurozone. As I said the other week, we are not going to have British kite marks. We're going to have exactly the same standards as everybody else in the EU, same size of screws, same size of everything. So we're not going to diverge in any way from single market rules. And that means we're going to be sucked into the maelstrom when the single market collapses. Except the single market won't collapse. The EU may collapse, but the single market won't.
One of the things which this has revealed, this collapse of Wilko, by the way, 400 shops they've got around the country are closing, it looks like, almost certainly. In fact, they were founded in 1930. But the Guardian have done a little bit of digging around the accounts, and they stepped into many high street gaps left by the collapse of Woolworths. So obviously, borrowed money to do that, financed by the banks to do that at the collapse of Woolworths in late 2008. The family paid themselves, though, £3 million in dividends in the 12 months to the end of February 22, despite falling to a loss that year. In fact, probably that all those extra dividends are probably why they made a loss, and the Guardian first revealed. So what's happened, it seems to me, looking at this, is that the family have decided to just cash in their shares or to cash in their power in the business and take the assets and the wealth of the business into their own pockets, and that's helped collapse it.
Yes, and that's quite rational if you are the controlling force within that business, isn't it? You don't lose out. You walk away with the dividends and you can sell it, the people who are going to lose out are the workers.
And so in the same year, the retailer borrowed £40 million. So they're obviously not, the balance sheet doesn't add up. I'd be very surprised if a bank would lend them that sort of money. But anyhow, the state of the high street. Yeah, pretty appalling, isn't it? And also the housing market. One of the things maybe driving the housing market, just keeping the bubble going, Martin, possibly, maybe the mass migration, don't you think? I mean, that's going to help keep house prices up anyway.
Well, the people that are coming into Britain mostly are on visas and they've got jobs, and of course that then keeps they'll want the middle class people who are coming here to work, that they will want somewhere to buy,
and well, not necessarily at least for very the very least to rent, wouldn't they?
Yes, but I mean, but the,
it's just going to keep the housing market
But what's going to happen is when the housing market bubble bursts, my landlords, who are buy-to-let landlords, will sell my house. And when they do that, everybody in my house, me and the other people who live there, will all be kicked out.
They're possibly contemplating that. Aren't they contemplating that right now?
I think they may well be. This is the issue. And that is going to create massive homelessness and further problems. And of course, homelessness doesn't mean that the economy picks up. If I've got nowhere to live, then I can't earn money and I can't spend it in the shops and so on. It's a vicious cycle. And I think this, what's going to happen in Europe now will be comparable in every way to what happened in the 1930s. This isn't just going to be a recession, which we will recover from. We're going to be deindustrialized completely by the Americans.
Migrant Crossing says the Daily Express, 2023 record smashed as 800 men cross in small boats in a single day this week. GB News Home Affairs editor has kept on top of today's arrival figures and believes they're published. The authorities will show that a record was smashed by around 50 migrants this week. So one day, 800 people coming across the channel.
Well, we discussed this last week. The French offered that we could go over there and process these people so they wouldn't have to get into boats at all. The British government refused, and we've got a huge backlog of people who haven't had their asylum requests processed, because there's been the policy since Theresa May articulated it of the hostile environment. So they don't want to process the claims because that would encourage more people to apply. That's the theory. So you've now got a massive backlog that has built up since the Tories came to power. And if you can't, these people can't have their claims processed, they can't work, which means you have to stick them in hotels. I was reading about the hotel in Llanelli is being turned into an asylum seekers hotel because they have to wait for 3 to 4 years before they can be assessed. And of course, if we did assess them in France, they could be taken over on the ferry and they could be looking for work the next day and they could be contributing
to the economy. Do we need people to do cheap labour here?
In actual fact, as you know, Tony, because of Brexit, there's a shortage in both hospitality and care, and we need people to do that.
Well, do you know why?
Why is that?
Because the wages are so low.
Yes, and the wages are so low because in care, it's decided by the government what those wages are going to be. And they could increase the wages. They could, and in fact, what's supposed to happen with all these foreign people from Poland and so on disappearing, the wages are supposed to go up, but that means that the government has got to pay those wages that go up, which means they've got to raise taxes on wealthy people, which they don't want to do. We need a massive redistribution of wealth. We're losing 3% of GDP per year as a result of Brexit, Tony. The fact figures are coming through. It's in Spain, the inflation rate is 1.5%. In Britain, it's nothing like that.
Is that because we're spending so much on benefits?
No, it's because all businesses in this country have a problem with high costs, because they've got lots of small businesses that used to export to Europe. They've just collapsed. I was reading about craft beer. 150 craft breweries have gone bust as a result of Brexit. Now, Brexit is going to carry on costing Britain right into the future. The whole of Europe is going to be deindustrialised, but
the beer is just a part of people not having spending power.
In Europe, the people in Europe don't want to buy craft beer from Britain anymore because they've got to fill loads of paperwork in if they want to import it. There's a huge bureaucratic obstacle course being created for British business. The reason why we didn't have our own...
Well, that's convenient for the German brewers, isn't it? I mean, of course, they want to create that sort of difficulty.
Listen, when we decided to have Brexit, Tony, all the other countries in Europe says if there is going to be unemployment as a result of this, it's your people that are going to be unemployed, not ours. Mm. And if you try and undercut us in any way, that's what the Trade and Cooperation Agreement says, we will raise tariffs on your stuff to keep it out.
Now, so Brexit was the starting of a trade war.
Yes, it is a trade war.
And is that necessary?
And we're
necessarily
not going to win, Tony, because we're one tiny country, well, and we've got 27 other countries who will not let us free ride. Well, they're not going to let us do that.
Are you a big fan of the World Trade Organization?
No,
tries
I'm not
to
a big fan of the World Trade
Organization. Tries to broker all these deals around the world to make it impossible for countries
to
resist.
Hang on a minute, Tony,
you're pro-Brexit. Hang on, to make it
you're
impossible
to resist.
You're supposed
to be in favour of the World Trade Organization.
No,
we want to trade under World Trade Organization rules. That's what we've had loads of UKIP coming saying exactly that. We don't want the single market, we want to trade under World Trade Organization rules. But in actual fact, as we agreed the other week, Britain is going to have exactly the same standards as the rest of the single market. Same size of screws, same size of electrical goods, all
well,
got
I don't
to
think
fit in
screw
with the single market.
Sizes are going to change, are
no.
they, because of Brexit? We're not going back to the old imperial system.
No, we're
we?
Not. We're going to have to use exactly the same standards
fact,
as everybody else
fact,
in the single
it,
market,
when,
but
when,
we won't get any say about what those standards
when
are.
When it comes to migration, it seems it's even increased.
No, there's more people flooding into Spain, Italy and Greece than into Britain.
And Germany.
And Germany,
way,
that's yeah. right. All of these countries have actually got more
Martin,
there's no need to, Martin,
European countries with most asylum seekers have been mapped, and the UK comes in number 6.
Actually,
we are quite low down the route.
Yes, that's right.
That is because there's this specific operation, and we've got this thing called the Channel in the way. Net immigration to the UK hit an all-time record high of 606,000 in 2022. Revised data from the Office for National Statistics shows some 46,000 crossed the Channel illegally in small boats, almost 25 times more than 3 years earlier. So this is a massive industry. An annual daily record of 755 this week makes the journey set earlier this week, tackling the issue remains one of the most pressing of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's 5 key priorities. Now, let's just look at Sunak for a minute. It doesn't really seem to be one of his priorities at all, does it?
What he's done is that the Tories as a whole have done is they've made a hostage fortune. They promised the Tory voters and the Tory membership that they were going to stop people coming in small boats. Unfortunately, it's like King Canute. These people are going to get in the boats and they're going to come. What you really need to do is process them in France, as the French have been suggesting all along, and you've got to accept your fair share of the refugees created by our wars in the Middle East, etc. All the countries in the Middle East have agreed that they're going to lift sanctions on Syria. Guess who isn't lifting sanctions on Syria? We're not. The French and the Germans both voted against going to war in Iraq, so they could easily say, all of these Iraqi refugees, you can have them, Britain, because you were the ones who wanted the war in Iraq. We didn't want it.
Meanwhile, the people who should be arrested are the people traffickers and the organised crime. Actually, Britain has. The UK authorities this week arrested the alleged mastermind behind the major Mediterranean migrant smuggling. This is a month or so ago. The United Kingdom's National Crime Agency announced the arrest of an Egyptian man believed to be a key player in orchestrating the illegal smuggling of thousands of migrants across the Mediterranean from North Africa and to Italy. The 40-year-old suspect was arrested in London, was thought to have liaised with human smuggling networks in North Africa, arranging boats for migrants, and then kept in touch with his criminal associates throughout the crossing. He was organising death-defying crossings from the UK. So that's interesting, isn't it? It's a little bit like David Southwell was saying. Actually, London seems to be a major centre for organised crime. I mean, this isn't going to stop people coming across the Channel, this arrest, but he feels comfortable enough to sit in London organising the people trafficking across the Mediterranean.
Well, virtually all organised crime is centred in London. And, of course, the City of London sucks in billions of pounds every day from developing countries in Africa. We imposed structural adjustment in Africa in the 1980s, Thatcherism for the Africans. That in fact meant they had to privatise, deregulate, all of that, and people lost their jobs and they lost their access to land. We forced that on them, and all of those countries. What may happen with what's going on in Niger and what's being discussed in South Africa this week is that the African countries may turn around to the City of London and say, we're not paying your debts. And if they do that, that will be the collapse of the banking system here, and it will intensify the recession.
We'll be talking about Niger a little bit later in relation to the assassination of Prigozhin. But I don't know if you've seen the interview between Tucker Carlson and Robert Kennedy, have you?
Well, I've read about it.
Well, it's about, I think, an hour and 20 minutes or so. But he touches on all sorts of fascinating points in it. One of which is the job that he's done. And this is why I wonder whether what's going on across the Channel is just a kind of copy of what's been happening at the California-Mexico border, Martin, for years and years. The idea is just, we want cheap labour, and there's actually not a lot that the government can do to stop it, because it's all run by organised crime.
No, it's not just run by organised crime. Organised crime is involved in all of this, because if you're going to cross a border illegally, then you need to organise yourselves to do it. But people who want to do it, and the reason they want to do it is because the economy in the south of Mexico, in Chiapas, was destroyed by the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was rammed down the throat of the Mexican government and the Mexican people.
It's interesting you say that, because as Robert Kennedy found out when he went down to the border to do his little documentary, Midnight at the Border, he found that actually Central Americans were only a tiny proportion of the number of people being smuggled across.
There's a documentary called Midnight at the Border about your visit to the border, California, Arizona border with Mexico. And I just want to play a clip from it for people who haven't seen it.
We did 2 weeks for travel from Senegal to Nicaragua. After Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, Mexico, and here. I'm going to New York to join my uncle. My dream is to live the dream American, to live in America, to work and to help my family.
We coordinate with the airport in Phoenix, and out they go to the final destination the same day.
Yeah, I hope to begin a new life. Yeah, my brother lives here. He's a citizen. Hey, good luck. Goodbye.
Most people bring the money or have a sponsor that buys their ticket.
What happens if family doesn't have the money to buy the plane ticket?
Well, FEMA reimburses us. We can buy the ticket and
you buy the ticket for
yeah.
What did you learn from that?
Well, you know, what I saw was so extraordinary that it took me 3 days to even understand what I was looking at. Because the first night I go to Yuma, and I get to the wall at 2 a.m. And I watch the first group. There's a gap in the wall there. And I watch the first group come across, which was about 110 men from West Africa, mainly from Ghana. They're all, you know, sort of military-age men from Ghana. And by calling them military-age men, I'm not making any implications about what they're here for. I'm just saying it's just a way of describing them. They were people, you know, between 18 and 25 from Ghana. So I expected to see a lot of Central Americans coming up, you know, and then and that was not what I saw. And then the next group was again about the same number. There were two busloads of people, and I interviewed every one of them. I talked to each one, and I want to say this: what we're seeing there, a lot of people come from to this issue of, you know, I think we need to close that wall, we need to close the border right now, and I'm going to explain to you why. But a lot of people come to this issue from sort of nationalistic or even a racist or xenophobic posture, and I'm not coming from that place. I'm coming from a place of compassion and a place of just concern for our country, and this is a heartbreaking humanitarian crisis, and everything that happens to these migrants along the way is terrible. So the next group that came, and what's happening to our country is a catastrophe. And by the way, I was a person who ridiculed Trump's wall. Okay, so, and now I've been down there, and I've talked to everybody down there, and, I have a different position. I don't think you need to build a 2,200-mile physical barrier from, you know, San Diego to Brownsville, Texas, but we definitely need physical barriers in the densely populated area, because we cannot survive with what's happening there now. The next group that came over were, again, about 110 people. There are two busloads. The cartels dropped them on right on the other side of the wall in these buses, and there's 55 people per bus. The next group, there were people from Azerbaijan, from Kazakhstan, from Uzbekistan, from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, from Tibet, Nepal, and many from India, and the most came from China. There were only two families we met the entire night who were from Latin America, none from Central America, interesting. One from Colombia and one from Peru, and they were the only ones who had legitimate claims, of asylum claims. Everybody else we talked to said, I'm here to have a better life. Well, that is not, if that's why you're coming to America, then you have to go through the front door.
You go to the embassy, yeah.
You go to the embassy. So they don't even have any legitimate claim to be in the United States. Nevertheless, the Border Patrol is so disillusioned and discouraged. Nine of the Border Patrol men, we were told, had committed suicide in the last year because of what they're being forced to do. They are not protecting the border. What they do is they fingerprint, they can only hold the migrants for 72 hours. They fingerprint them, and they see if they're if they have a criminal record. If they have a criminal record, they're put in a different process. But otherwise, they're then asked where they want to go. And if they don't have a plane ticket, they are brought to the airport. The DHS purchases them a ticket and sends them anywhere they want to go in the United States.
So the country's getting poorer every year. Our country's getting poorer every year. We're in a poor place right now. Well, how? Who came up with? I mean, why do we owe plane tickets to people who come here illegally?
As far as I can tell, and there's a lot of evidence for this, and it's in our film, is that the Biden administration came in, you know, in the same position I was, which is the wall is bad, but more importantly. Any idea that Donald Trump had is a bad idea. So they just opened the border, and they've had this open border policy where they have not hired the judges. That's the most important thing that needs to be done. The judges need to be hired so that these cases, the asylum cases, can be adjudicated right at the border, and people who are not entitled to asylum are sent back. But that's not what's happening. What happens is, they're all given claims, and they're told to appear in court, and they go to an arraignment fairly soon after arriving in Boston or New York or Miami or wherever, Minneapolis, wherever they're going. And then they're given a court date, which on average is 7 years out. So
I hope next time I get arrested, I get the same courtesy.
They're in our country then for 7 years, but... And let me just tell you from their point of view what's happened. First of all, the cartels are now controlling our immigration policy in the United States. All of these people who came across knowing exactly what was going to happen to them because they had seen it on advertisements the cartels are sending around the world on TikTok and on YouTube. It tells you what you need to do to get in, what airports you fly into, what visas you get, how to get them, and how to get to the cartel parking lots where the buses will take you. Some of them fly into Nicaragua. Most of them fly directly to Mexico City and from anywhere in the world. These are not, you know, Central American, Latin American. They're coming from everywhere. They fly to Mexico City. The cartels assist them getting a Mexican visa. And then they are put on a domestic flight to Mexicali. And in Mexicali, there's a big parking lot with buses operated by the cartels. The cartels charge them between $10,000 and $15,000 a piece to get through. And then they drive them up to the wall and they unload them. We watch them unloading them on the other side. Large numbers of them get abused. They get extorted. They get exploited. They get robbed, raped, beaten. The Peruvian family that I met had every penny taken from them. He said my whole life savings was taken from me. There's a tree that we could see from where we were in the when it was daylight. It's called the rape tree, where the cartels extract final payment from women who are crossing the border. If there are attractive women that they, in their view, and I don't mean physically attractive, but attractive for whatever their purpose is, to sell or to, you know, to traffic or whatever, or children. Those children are separated out. The Colombian family had lost a girl. And a teenage girl, and you know the father was desperate, and she had been separated from them by the cartels before they passed.
Oh my gosh!
And 85,000 children have disappeared in this process. It's monstrous.
So all the
but then let me tell you this: they get into our country, and there's a lot of people who are well-meaning. Mainly liberal people who care, who, you know, see themselves as deeply caring people, who say we should have sanctuary cities and we should, you know, these people should be treated with dignity. But what really happens to them in real life is that they get here and then they, for 7 years, none of them are legal. So they are now subject to terrible exploitation by unscrupulous employers all over this country. They're getting paid $6 or $5 an hour because they have no leverage in their employer.
Of course.
And that dampens the wages for every other American.
That's exactly right. It steals the leverage from American workers, too.
And there's 16 million of them here now. And they're crushing the social safety system, social safety nets in cities like New York. Has 95,000 of them have landed in New York. New York is now thinking of turning Roosevelt Island into an open-air refugee camp. And there's a proposal that was on Bloomberg of turning Central Park or parts of it into open-air camps for migrants. Oh, and that, you know, Eric Adams, who's the mayor, has been saying this has got to end. We have to close the border. And a lot of these mayors who were people who were saying we're sanctuary cities and getting that, aligning themselves with that, are now seeing what it really means. And it does not mean treating people humanely. It is the worst possible thing we can do. Meanwhile, 7 million have come across in 3 years, 7 million illegally. In that same time, there's only been 3.1 million legal immigrants. So these are the people who waited in line. For every one of them, there are more than two illegal ones coming across and taking those places. And that, a lot of the, it's not something that's sustainable. It's something that needs to end right away. And the cartels, which are making billions, the Mexican drug cartels, are literally running U.S. immigration policy this time, not the President of the United States.
So, interesting take there from a Democrat president, Martin, isn't
not
it?
Not president.
Presidential candidate. If we were to be hearing something from the Democrat president, it wouldn't be quite so coherent, would it? There's all sorts in there. Senegal, Tibet, Nepal. Actually, you said the most of them were from China, interestingly. I mean, are they feeling oppressed in China? No, they're economic migrants. These are people who are trying to get themselves a better life. And he's also saying that this is organized crime. He talks about the Mexican drug cartels. Now, they're some of the most ruthless organized criminals in the world.
They are. And U.S. authorities aren't able to stop them bringing drugs into the U.S. and they won't be able to stop them bringing.
Well, this is the question. Are they able? Either? Are they really able? So surely if there's a political will at the top and within the Department of Justice and within the military, because we know that the U.S. military is involved in massive drug smuggling, then isn't that why these organized crime activities are allowed to continue? It's a bit like Al Capone running the show.
Well, it is. And of course, the economic policies that are imposed in Ghana, in Senegal, in Central America, have been imposed by Wall Street and the City of London. The Mexicans, and don't forget, this border on the Rio Grande is only there because the Americans invaded Mexico and took over. There's a bit of a clue in the names. California, Los Angeles, San Francisco. These aren't English names, are they? They're Spanish names because all of that region was at one time part of Mexico. Okay? And of course, they've talked about going over the border. One of the Republican senators, we need to go over the border and sort out what's happening.
So do you agree with Robert Kennedy that the trade has got to stop?
He can say it's got to stop, and he's trying to get elected, so he's saying that. But I'll bet you, if he does get elected, he won't necessarily be able to stop it because there's a global economic crisis, which has been brought about by Wall Street and the City of London. And it's put the whole world on the road.
Well, there's not a global economic crisis for the cartels, is there?
No, because, of course, there's always money to be made in a crisis by the right kind of people.
So you're saying that, effectively, organised crime has won?
Yes, because the CIA works closely with the cartels. As we know, Pablo Escobar's son in Colombia said, everybody knows that my dad worked for the CIA. There are 7 million people in Colombia who have been displaced by the war. So they're inside Colombia, but they've been driven off their land.
So it's impossible to solve because someone's picked up a gun and they're threatening the elected officials and the border force there.
Yes, and that's what happens in Mexican cities and in Latin American cities. It's actually very lawless, Tony, because we've got illegal drugs markets. We should legalise drugs. That's what the left-wing presidents in Central America and other places are saying. In Peru, we've just had a coup against the democratically elected government, and the poorest people are being pushed to the wall by the Americans. And then there's people get on their bikes and say, right, well, they follow the money. The money's being sucked out of all the third world countries into the United States. And of course, the people follow the money. It's the free market, Tony. That's what happens. Mm. David Stockman, who's a 9/11 truther and was an advisor to Reagan, he's a free market right-wing economist. And he points out that given the fact that mainstream Americans aren't having children, that unless they do get some people coming in, the social security system's going to collapse.
No, no one's talking about that really, are they? Because that's not what we're discussing at all. What we're discussing is the legal routes versus the illegal routes, and it's the organised criminals that are making money out of just really, I mean, yes.
They're making money out of the misery of ordinary people.
Yeah,
and the misery is created by US economic policy.
He said it's for every 7 million illegal migrants, there's 3.1, well, it's roughly half illegal. So, yeah, so for every migrant in America, two of them are illegal and one is legal. But it doesn't mean to say that the legal ones are going to be stopped. I mean, another thing which was coming up there was people meeting...
The illegal ones aren't going to be stopped either, because the market works, Tony.
Well, we'll see.
Yes, we will see.
I don't think it can carry on forever.
Trump was in power for 4 years and he said, we're going to build a wall. People get round that wall. There's always been a wall there, but they can get round it. Because money talks, Tony. And it's the economic policies and also the warfare policies that Britain in particular has pursued. We've destabilised the whole of the Middle East. That's not far away from where we live.
So does this suit some of the elites, you think, in Britain? Do they have these illegal migrants?
It suits the elites in the US, because they started the war in Syria and Iraq, and Britain helped them, because it undermines the European Union. The European Union is being hung out to dry by the US and British elites. And part of that is smashing Syria. As I said earlier, all Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia, have agreed to lift sanctions on Syria. Guess who doesn't want to lift sanctions on Syria? We don't. And of course, that means Syrians will be turning up on the Channel beaches saying, we want to come to you, because there's no work, there's nothing down for us in Syria. And they're going to come. You can say you don't want them to come, and you can see that it's going to cause all kinds of problems, but the idea that they're just going to go... Did you see what happened in Saudi Arabia? The Saudi Arabian border guards killed hundreds of Ethiopian migrants as they got off the boats. Hundreds of them, using weaponry supplied by Britain, because they're our allies, and they helped us to destroy Syria. Don't you remember? Thousands dead, millions displaced. That's all British policy.
Well, it's interesting that they have to bring the military in rather than the police. I mean, you know.
Well, in Saudi Arabia, there's no messing around. You know, they do it proper Priti Patel style with machine guns.
Oh, used machine guns.
No, she didn't, did she? And if she's not going to use machine guns, then you've got to feed them.
Priti Patel style with machine guns. I mean, what do you... you know,
yes, all right.
It's just silly, isn't it? You're trivialising it. But
no, people are being killed at borders. Did you see what happened in Mexico? Not in Mexico, in Morocco? The police shot down loads of people who were trying to climb a fence. If you really want to stop them, that's what you got to do.
Those people weren't expecting to be shot, though, were they? They were expecting to get into Saudi Arabia, no problem, because there is a market for them in Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's right, because Ethiopia is a poor place, and Saudi Arabia, with its Western allies, dominates all sorts of things. I mean, the Saudi elite, which is most of the population, don't do any work anyway. All the work is done by people who come in as migrant workers. But they are our allies, Tony. The people at Filton get their Christmas money selling these weapons to the Saudis. The British military is embedded with the Saudis discussing how to kill people in Yemen. The biggest catastrophe on the planet, not in Ukraine, in Yemen. And we, British military, directly involved in the killing. And then we say we don't want refugees.
Well, I'm not sure that there is more people died in Yemen than in Ukraine, actually, no. Both of them pretty comparable, yeah, actually, in terms of hundreds of thousands.
In Yemen, lots of people are dying of starvation because of the blockade of the whole country, which we support.
And cholera, of course. They had the biggest cholera outbreak of the century, in fact, in Yemen. So, but isn't that sorting itself out, Yemen, now?
Not really. I'm afraid the possibility, you see, both Iran and Saudi Arabia were taken into the BRICS. We haven't discussed the BRICS meeting in Johannesburg, but Argentina, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iran are all joining, and a couple of others are all joining BRICS. And they're going to form a different architecture for international finance to smash the Western monopolistic system, and if countries were allowed to pursue policies which could put their own people to work without all the resources being stolen, like the French have been stealing the resources in Niger since the 19th century, then people would be able to work where they come from. But we can't do that because we have deracinated the whole planet. People, for example, small farmers all over the world have been smashed by US subsidized agribusiness. So that in Mexico, they signed the North American Free Trade Agreement, and US farmers who are subsidized by the government have been allowed to dump their stuff on the Mexicans, wiping out their small farmers completely. And that is all imposed by the United States on the Mexicans. And then, of course, these people knock on the door and say, I want a job, please, because you've just got me up my family farm, you've destroyed it.
And in the meantime, of course, as we're referring to Yemen just there, the old city of Sana'a, for example, is being destroyed virtually. I mean, this is a World Heritage Site, UNESCO World Heritage Site. Yahoo News has got quite a nice piece with by Robbie Corey Boulay. This is from last weekend, saying how this chap, Doa Al-Wasai, spent many happy years working as a tour guide in the old city of Yemen's capital Sana'a, showing foreigners its hidden hammams and markets teeming with silver and spices. After nearly a decade of war, that life seems like a distant memory. He says the old city itself, Wasai's childhood home, is cut off from the world. Its warrens of thousands of years old rammed earth buildings have fallen into disrepair. Tourism, he says, opened my eyes to my own culture. He said, reflecting as 40 years old, how he gained a deeper appreciation of clothing and food of his own people by explaining them to outsiders. She comfortably spoke English and German, but now her foreign language skills are wasting away, although she reckons it's just as well. There are no words to express the catastrophe here in English, German, or even French. It was a World Heritage Site, and the old city's been classified now as in danger since 2015. Inhabited without interruption for more than 2,500 years, the area's mosques and burnt brick tower houses are now faced with direct threats from airstrikes and indirect threats associated with lack of upkeep. As she waits impatiently for the war to end, she's kept painstaking records of the old city's decline. Now, I mean, this is just a tragic story of what we've done, we and the Saudis, to Yemen.
It is. And this is, you know, people don't realise, Britain is not a sort of country that minds its own business.
It's not surprising, is it, that people will want to go to Saudi Arabia from Yemen? That was the border where all these people were shot dead.
Well, they were coming from Ethiopia.
Yeah, but going through the Yemeni border, yes, into Saudi, yeah, Arabia. They were maybe,
well, they're not going to be going to Yemen to starve, are they? They're going to go somewhere else where they can perhaps get a job on a construction site. That's probably what they're looking for. But they got a bullet supplied by Britain and shot by the Saudis.
Yeah, so so what's happening with Saudi Arabia these days? You're talking about BRICS. They want to join, don't they?
They do. And Iran and Saudi Arabia have joined. They joined this week, along with Egypt and Argentina. Now, that is significant, because the Iranians and the Saudis are now talking about joint naval patrols in the Persian Gulf to protect shipping, and that basically the British and the Americans should just go away. That is what's being discussed.
It's funny, isn't it, how all these economics really is all about politics, really, because they're, well, it is. I mean, you know, what you're seeing is political allegiance is changing as people join a different economic alliance. In fact, ECOWAS over in West Africa, which is based around Nigeria, was a Western military alliance, is actually, the E in ECOWAS is the economic alliance. So it's the same thing, really.
Well, politics and economics are intertwined, are they not? Political economy is what it used to be called, rather than economics. And, of course, when somebody blows up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, that isn't a free market, is it? It just means that Germany is permanently plunged into darkness.
The new members...
That's not free competition, is it?
The new members of the BRICS is Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Iran, very significantly, Iran... Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I mean, it's almost like the world is starting to divide into two camps for a third world war.
Well, it is. That is exactly what is happening. And it's basically the old Western Five Eyes powers who have dominated the world for 500 years and have been on a rampage since 9/11. They are now facing their comeuppance because the Russian army is smashing NATO in Ukraine. And there's nothing NATO can do about it.
Well, we go on to international stuff and Donald Trump's Twitter space with whatever they call it. I mean, I thought Twitter was supposed to be for short things, but this is like an hour long interview with Donald Trump. Obviously, the other interview for the vice president is not going to be anywhere near as interesting, although that was on American television. This, the more interesting one by far, was on Twitter, because Donald Trump is a front runner for the Republican nomination to be president in the elections next year in the States. Anyway, more news in Britain here, and Sadiq Khan is facing calls to resign after his website said a white, his Twitter account says, a white family are not real Londoners. Labour's politician sparked a backlash over the picture caption. I mean, he deleted the tweet, but this is a little bit cheeky of Khan, isn't it? Saying that white people are not real Londoners. Why would he think something like that? This is last weekend. Yeah, that's the actual words, and they've got the caption here, which I'll put up on our show page. White family are not real Londoners. And, I mean, you know, you could say that because that white people may not be a majority in London anymore, that he's right.
Well, I think the fact that he's taken it down suggests that he realises that he's offended people by presenting it in that kind of way. But, you know, if people don't like him, they can vote him out at the next election. Although the Tory woman who's going to be standing against him is not going to win, frankly. She's hopeless.
So why have the Tories pitched somebody so useless? I suppose you could also ask, why have the Tories got such a useless Prime Minister?
Well, that's right. It's because they're choosing people that they think that they like, because they come out with the stuff
I totally disagree with you. I remember when Keir Starmer took over the Labour Party and it became clear what kind of lack of personality he had, there was only one way he was ever going to be actually elected, and that is if the Tory party had someone pretty hopeless to put up against him.
Well,
this is an establishment stitch-up, really, I think.
Well, it is an establishment stitch-up, because the whole thing's an establishment stitch-up. You get beaten. I used to compare Tony Blair to the nice cop and Thatcher to the nasty cop. So you get dragged down the station, beaten up, cigarette burns, you know, and then Starmer comes along and says, look, have a nice cup of tea and sign the confession. That's what it's about. And it's the first past-the-post system in the US and in Britain that allows that to happen. Now, that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen in other systems. It does. Money talks in any system. But in our system, it's designed. It's a feature. It's not a bug. It's a feature. It's designed to be oligarchic. It's designed to be top-down. And that's the way that, you know, that's the way the oligarchy wants it.
So next weekend, the ULEZ, the... what do you know what it stands for? Ultra low brain zone, because it's nothing to do. It's just a tax, isn't it? Well, I mean, particularly when the very, very expensive new cars aren't taxed at all.
Well, I know you're opposed to ULEZ, but we will see when it comes to the mayoral election in London.
Can we just not talk about it? I'd like to hear your view just on the principles of it rather than the politics of it, because that's rather dull. What about whether this is a justified tax and it's going to really make much
difference? The purpose of it is to reduce damage to air quality.
Rubbish. The purpose of it is to just raise money because local government is underfunded.
That is not the stated purpose.
Well, we know that. But listen, we don't deal with stated purposes do we?
I think you the problem with your approach to this is you've just got one dimensional attitude.
No, it isn't. It's a five dimensional attitude. The idea is we don't take these things at face value. We pull them apart.
You might be right and you might be wrong, Tony. I don't necessarily have to agree with your analysis.
I'm not asking you to. All I'm saying is that there are different points of view. And generally on this programme, we do not take at face value what politicians say. We're doing it for this reason. We don't take that at face value. Just as we're not going to be later on taking at face value what all the press is saying about the Russians killing. It's funny, isn't it, how all of these attacks by drones and plane crashes in Russia are all caused by the Russians themselves. So we don't take things at face value, is what I'm saying.
Well, let me just make a comment. Last week you had an interviewee from the Andrew Marr show, who was talking about the Uxbridge by-election. And as he pointed out, there were 800 green votes which could have gone to the Labour Party. Those green voters wanted ULEZ. And if you actually analyse the returns for Uxbridge, more people wanted ULEZ in Uxbridge than didn't want it. But first past the post, let the Tories through. And of course, that's the reality, Tony. More people in Uxbridge voted for you, Les, than voted against it. But it didn't matter, because first past the post.
Well, is Uxbridge outside the zone or inside the
zone?
It's
outside the zone at the moment, but it's going to be extended to it, isn't it? And that's what they're moaning about.
Well, let us see. But there's an increasing rebellion in London, particularly around the edges, where people haven't got a public transport alternative. And, you know, just as soon as they pull out of their drive every day, they now have to pay £12.50. This is road pricing. So the idea is if, you know, when you go off to Hereford and back again, you're going to have to pay for every single mile on top of your tax.
Not in
this particular. That's where all this is going.
Not in my vehicle.
This is yours is all is exempt, is it?
Yes, because it's an unleaded petrol vehicle. These vehicles are old diesel vehicles, the ones that are being
These
charged.
Are the ones that we were advised by Ed Miliband to buy.
Not Ed Miliband, by John Prescott.
I think it was
John
Ed
Prescott
Miliband.
Said everybody should buy diesel, and then they suddenly realised, oh no, it's really bad.
I think it was Ed Miliband, actually, at the time, because they were less polluting.
No, Ed Miliband wasn't even in the government.
He was. Yeah, hang on a minute. No, he was under. Anyway, we can look that up. Yeah. But the point is, what do you think is a good policy or a bad policy?
I think it's a policy that needs to be discussed, and people have just got some things.
Armour-plated surveillance cameras all over the country.
Well, all right, Tony.
That's okay, is it?
I'll tell you, if you don't like it, you could stand in the election.
You know as well as I that the origin of this was in Northern Ireland, wasn't it?
Yes.
The glutton system,
okay.
Where they're checking everybody's number plates everywhere they go.
Yes, this
is rather useful, isn't it, if you wanted to keep everybody under surveillance.
Yes, but that's the way the world is moving.
A technocracy.
It is a technocracy.
It doesn't have to move that way at all.
No, you're choosing,
yes, that's a good thing, let's
no.
do it.
No, Tony,
it's
just
not a good thing.
It's a reality. Everybody's got a
so
cell
we just
phone.
Have to, we just have to go, oh.
No, we've got to discuss all of these things, and then we have debates, and then we have elections. Piers Corbyn stood in the Uxbridge by-election against Ulez, and he got, 100 votes, Tony.
That's nothing to do, as you know. It's to do with that first-past-the-post.
It's a first-past-the-post system, that's right.
Anyway, let's have a listen
there
now
go.
To...
It's all rubbish, isn't it?
What is?
The first-past-the-post system allows minorities to dominate when they shouldn't.
Yeah, well, I agree, yeah. Anyway, so here is, minorities like Sadiq, what did Richard Littlejohn call him in the Daily Mail? Genghis Khan, that's right.
Anyway, that's not racist at all, is it? No.
No, it's not. No, why should it be?
Anyway, he will stand in the election when the next election is in London. When is it, Tony?
2 years' time?
Yeah,
it?
And he'll win. Oh, sure. He'll get millions of votes.
We shall see.
Yeah, I think he will, Tony.
If he even stands.
He won't sway the Tory suburbs.
What about Marvin here in Bristol? Is he going to win?
Stand, is he? Because there isn't going to be a mayor election.
No. He might stand as a councillor and still get booted out. Or maybe the Labour Party knew that if he stood as an MP, he wouldn't stand a chance.
Well, he's not going to.
I think what's going on.
He's not going to be the Labour candidate in Bristol.
What's going on is the Labour Party is basically crashing and burning. And that the Green Party is ready to take over. So anyway, let's have a listen now to what I think is one of the most interesting interviews about you, Les. And this is 12-year-old Jasmine. What she says, the actual title of the video I took it from is called Jasmine Drops a Nuke on Sadiq Khan.
We the people have all been sold. We have been sold to large corporations like products, or slaves for a better word. We are now slaves and owned by corporations who, as crazy as it sounds, has assumed they can do with us exactly whatever as they please. These evil corporations are using the World Economic Forum to change the world in ways that will see us all imprisoned inside 15-minute AI-controlled open prisons, or smart prisons. They are building them around us, right now. The COVID pandemic was just a test run. And between then and now, they've kept the populations distracted with fears of a world war. There will be no war, I promise you. Because at night, when we are sleeping, they are out there, on the roads, laying the cables and building these 5G towers. Do you think they'd be doing that if they were planning to have a third world war? The ugly, giant 5G towers are the prison bars to keep us in our 15-minute prisons. Then, they will force us onto a digital ID. And we will need that to access our bank accounts, supermarkets, hospitals, about everything. We'll be kept in these open prisons. If we try to go outside of our zone, our boundary, our ID will become useless. It will completely switch off. This prison is being built right now in front of everyone's eyes. And none of this is about saving the planet. It's about controlling the people. And if you think I'm just a midget conspiracy theorist, well, look around you. They aren't starting these 15-minute zones by improving the public transport within them or improving the public services within each zone. They are starting these 15-minute cities by erecting barricades, building 5G towers, and installing thousands of surveillance cameras. And all the whilst, they keep everyone distracted with threats of a nuclear war. We need to stand firm today. It is our constitutional duty to stand against this evil. Our ancestors did not die for us to shy away from a captured and hostile government. If we don't stand up now, then we can kiss our freedoms goodbye. Because before we know it, they will have us all on a digital ID. That means wherever we go and whatever we do, we will need our digital ID. Our digital ID will enable us, or it will deny us, access to shops, gyms, leaving our homes, leaving our 15-minute prison zones. Just think about that. And why do you think they want to imprison us all? I'll give you a clue. Oh yeah, go on then. I'll give you a clue. Vaccines. As Tony Blair has stated, they will attach these toxic injections to the digital ID. And the only reasons for that are depopulation and genetic engineering, in a crude attempt to turn those who survive the depopulation agenda into cyborgs that can be connected to the internet, and what they call the internet of bodies. This is in store for all of us. It is an attempt to impoverish and enslave every single man, woman, and child on the planet. And do not think for one second that just because our MPs wear nice suits and can muster up a smile once in a while, do not think for one second that they will not inflict the most horrific atrocities on any of us. Do not believe it for a second. Remember, we do not have an elected government in the UK. Our government has been sold to these unelected corporations. We must rise up against this beast. We have no other choice. We must rise up in defiance against this nightmare. It is down to all of us to resist these two things. The digital ID and the CBDCs, and keep using cash. The Bill of Rights Act of 1688 is in place to protect us. We can remove any government or system that is tyrannical. It was put in place to protect us from the kind of tyrants who have captured our government buildings in Westminster. The Act of Unity, 1707, freedom of travel and navigation. We have the right to travel around the UK freely. This is the law. But these tyrants are looking to remove this right. And they may try to fool you by saying the Act has been amended. It has not. Did you consent to any amendments? Because without our consent to the amendments do not exist. They may exist in the minds of tyrants who want to destroy our lives, but actually, the Act of Unity stands as firm today as it did in 1707. Do not believe otherwise. Sadiq Khan thinks that so long as he screams and shouts like some raving lunatic control freak, that he can bully us into compliance with his tyrannical rules. This man is not fit to be in our government at all and needs to be removed from his position immediately. He has forgotten that he works for us. We are not his slaves. Our ancestors, our grandfathers, gave their lives for our freedom. They went through hell in two world wars, living in wet and stinky trenches. Winston Churchill himself would be turning in his grave at what is going on today. So let me ask, does anyone not understand the meaning of non-compliance? It means do not pay any ultra-low zone charges. Do not pay any charges relating to your freedom to travel. If they send you a bill, send it straight back to them. Just write across their bill, no contract, no consent. That means, unless they hold a contract signed by you agreeing to pay, you do not have to pay. It's as simple as that. These low emission charges are the litmus test. If you are too cowardly to stand against these charges, then what? We may as well go and roll up your sleeves for the next bioweapon. We must not comply with any more rules, acts, or statutes that infringe on our basic human rights, such as the right to not wear a face mask, the right to gather in groups of friends, and the right to leave our houses as and when we choose, or to move around our country freely, and of course, the right to not to be injected with experimental injections. We all need to say, no, I will not inject myself with poison. I will not be your slave. I will not comply. All together, resist, defy, do not comply. Resist, defy, do not comply. Resist, defy, do not comply. Do not comply. Listen to me, you grown-ups. My life is ahead of me. I have a future. I want to have a future. I've planned what I want in my future. I've planned what I want for my job. I want a family. I want to have a normal life, a normal future. And I know that, and my future does not include these chips and these digital ID and all these stupid 15-minute prison books. I want freedom. I want a free future. I don't want to be controlled. This is not the future that I want. Finally, in order for we the people to create a better and fairer world, two conditions must first be met. The first is that we switch off and unplug our TVs. The second is that we humans, all of us, come together as one people in defiance against this tyranny. And the way to do that is through peaceful non-compliance.
So that's 12-year-old Jasmine, Martin. Now, I think some rather flaky advice there from the 12-year-old, but I mean, you get the general gist, which is this is a dystopia which is being created around us, a kind of open prison.
Well, she's a kind of Greta Thunberg for GB News, isn't she? She's she's obviously quite well spoken, and she's got, you know, she's got her views there. She keeps going on that the Act of Union of 1707 gives us the right to travel anywhere in the country. The Act of Union of 1707, don't forget that at that stage, both England and Scotland did not have a democratic government. Neither of them were democratic.
Well, that doesn't mean to say you can't travel.
No, but
dictators let you travel.
You will find that, this thing of closing off roads and so on and preventing people from going in certain roads and some roads being one ways and all the rest of it, it's called traffic management.
Well, yes, well, some people call it progress. In fact, here in Bristol, we've got Megan, can't remember her second name, Streb, maybe? The people who are organising this are basically sustrans cycle campaigners, so they just see cars as dangerous and in the way. But the thing is that do we really want a city that's just designed as a cycle city?
Well, I can see that there is bound to be what happens when you're talking about the nitty gritty of local policy is that people don't actually agree. Neighbours don't agree. So in many streets where people have got children, for example, they want them blocked off. People without children want to be able to drive in and out. It just depends.
I think maybe,
and of course,
maybe
we have elections to resolve this.
Maybe,
she's saying don't comply. If you don't comply
with something that
is the law, you'll be fined and eventually you will go to prison.
Well, obviously, but one thing that doesn't help is if you're lying about the reason you're doing something. And this is, I think, what people particularly don't like about, I mean, this is nudge unit stuff. Oh, well, if you say this and say this, you might get the result you want. But people can see through a lot of this stuff, that if there was a decision, say, we want to keep cars out of this area around the city centre and we think it's going to be really good and have just cycles, well, it's not necessarily a bad thing. But what they're saying is that we're doing it actually just to clean the air up. By the way, if you've got a brand new 60 grand Range Rover like the one I just bought, you don't have to pay anything.
The thing is, Tony, these things are decided at local elections. And the fact is that Sadiq Khan overwhelmingly was elected, and he will be elected again. Most people just do not have all of these scars.
You're just ignoring what I said, aren't you? Which is, if you lie about why you're doing something, the election almost becomes void, isn't it? To have some sort of truth and interrogation and a proper opposition, don't you?
No, there is no obligation on politicians to tell the truth. It's up to the voters to decide whether they're telling the truth, and if they don't think they're telling the truth, they can vote against them. That's what it's about.
What we seem to have now in politics is this kind of fake consensus with various parties all agreeing together. I mean, do you remember we had Neil McAvoy explaining just how it all works over in Wales between Plaid Cymru and Labour? They have a little committee that sits down, decides on everything, and that both of the parties basically agree because they're told to agree.
Both of the parties do agree. They are the government of Wales. They're in coalition, Tony. Just as there was a coalition between the Lib Dems and the Tories. This is how...
And there is a coalition now between Starmer and the Tories.
Well, no, there isn't a
coalition. Well, there is.
No, there
isn't. Not formally, but there is.
Starmer is tacking to the right to try and attack former Tory voters in the Red Wall seats. But he's going to go down. It's quite possible they're going to lose to the SNP in Glasgow. Because in Glasgow, they don't think like people in England do. And they're not interested in... the Scottish government has actually increased payments to families with children at a time when Starmer is saying we're not going to reinstate benefits for
it's
children.
It's a very good article about the ULEZ was published last week. Listening to the discussion over ULEZ expansion feels like an action replay of the way in which many were convinced to overreact to COVID, leading to policy responses which cause significantly more harm than good. The ULEZ discussion, in inverted commas, has all of the same elements, with modelled health benefits calculated by Imperial College model and Mayor Khan's justification that he is saving lives, implying that opponents are wannabe murderers. Of course, this time around, the public is thankfully much more sceptical. In this short note, I will set out how those lives saved numbers were derived, and to demonstrate that the best the numbers are seriously misrepresented and at worst completely wrong. So, I mean, this is just lies, damn lies and statistics, rather like during the pandemic.
Well, we've debated this pandemic loads and loads of times.
Good old Imperial College again.
Yes, well, it isn't just Britain that had a pandemic, Tony. It was a global pandemic. I sent you Kirillov's reports to the United Nations this week. Kirillov being the head of the chemical warfare, biological warfare troops of the Russian Federation. And in that submission to the United Nations Security Council, he accuses the United States of creating COVID-19 as a bioweapon using EcoHealth Alliance inside the Wuhan lab. Now, that means that's World War III, Tony. And various countries took various measures in dealing with the
pandemic.
Why haven't we seen?
That sounds quite significant. Why haven't the Western press been talking about that?
Because they don't want to talk about that. The head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard said as soon as it broke out, we think this is a biological warfare attack on us. They just assassinated Soleimani. Trump had just assassinated him. And then it broke out in Qom and in Tehran amongst the leadership. It didn't come in through a port or anything, and it was a different strain of COVID from the one in China. And loads of elderly politicians and generals and so on died, and they perceived that immediately as a biological warfare attack. Meanwhile, back in Blighty, people are complaining about having to wear masks. It's biological warfare, folks. You can't take chances with stuff like that.
So what's the significance of... And he said he sent it to the UN.
He sent it to the UN Security Council. They've submitted it to it, and they're basically accusing that because they've got all of these documents that they seized in these biolabs in the Ukraine. Now, he's basically saying, we think you did this. You created COVID-19 deliberately. That should be news all over the West, but of course it isn't, because in any case, we all know the Russians, what can you do?
The Russians just lie
enemy
all the
of
time.
Human beings, aren't they? I mean, they're just robots.
So what's your scenario for what's happened then if Kirillov is right?
Well, what I think happened, and we've debated this many to the time, is that it was a deliberate attack to try and mess up the Chinese economy, and it looks as if it may ultimately succeed, because they're now moving into a property bubble which may collapse the Chinese economy. The other thing that they're doing, of course, is they've stopped supplying chips to the Chinese companies, which is an attempt to try and strangle the Chinese economy. Just before the pandemic, half of the pigs and all of the chickens in China died of mysterious viral infections. We are at war. It's a war. And it's not about trying to control us and digitalize us. Yes, it is about that. But of course, it's just about killing people.
Well, it is. It's about both, actually. What it's about is it's about a maniacal elite, like almost like Nero fiddling while Rome burns. Is what they're doing is they're taking on these massive foreign powers in a potential third world war coming down the line. And they're also taking on their own people. In fact, it was Kees van der Pel, isn't it, in his book, recent book. I can't remember the title of it now, but he explains, look, there is this going to be the elites know there's going to be an uprising in democratic countries, and so they're preparing to put it down before it starts.
Well, this is all of a piece, but I think a lot of people seem to see this in terms of what, you know, all this the stuff that that the girl was coming up with, Winston Churchill will be turning in his grave and all this. It's sort of Daily Telegraph style rhetoric. We are at war. We've been at war since 9/11. Millions are dead. Millions were killed by COVID. Probably millions are being killed by these mRNA vaccines. But of course, nobody in China or Russia has had an mRNA vaccine, nor has anybody in Cuba. Lots of people in the poor developing world haven't had any vaccines at all. And, you know, they may try and pull another stunt like this, but it's pretty clear to me, even when it came out, that in 2019, the Israeli Defense Forces were told by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States of America that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China. Nobody knew that except the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States. I think the Russian General Staff and the Chinese General Staff and the Iranian General Staff could put two together. It's all, the pandemic was a pandemic, it's warfare.
And if it's not on your bookshelf, I want to know why not. Its title is States of Emergency, Keeping the Global Population in Check by Kees van der Pel. Using fear to grease the wheels of global transformation. Kees van der Pel actually is the way you pronounce it, an author we've interviewed on this show, an author of Distinction, writes that the global ruling class or oligarchy used COVID-19 to seize power by declaring a state of global emergency. He explains that the information technology revolution, by creating a global information and communication system, was ushering in a social transformation inimical to the oligarchy's hegemony over society. In order to stop this transformation, the global elite used lockdowns, mandates, censorship, and controlled narratives to seize control over populations. He makes a cogent argument. He shows the pandemic is a political emergency, not a medical one. Its purpose was to suppress populations and transition to an authoritarian state and social structure. That's Paul Craig Roberts.
Yes, and I agree with them about all of that, apart from a bit about COVID-19. COVID-19 itself is a bioweapon, and that's why China locked down, because
it's not saying it's not a bioweapon, is it? No, he's saying that was the real purpose of the. I mean, you're saying it was just an attack on China. He's saying it's an attack on the world.
It's an attack on the world. And what happened with China? China actually dodged that bullet. They're not necessarily going to dodge the bullet from the collapse of their property sector, but. It's quite clear to the Chinese that the Americans are not prepared to let them develop. They're trying to de-develop them. They're not going to stand for that. Why would they? They think that they were deliberately attacked by COVID-19. That's what they say. That's what the Russians are saying. That's what the Iranians are saying. That's why they're all in South Africa plotting to bring about the downfall of the deep state in the West, because they're the guilty parties.
We've also got a clip from John Pilger now, looking at how propaganda hides the true face of war. I think so much of this program does concentrate on propaganda and skewed perceptions. And, of course, we'll be dealing with the skewed perception of the shooting down or the bomb on a plane carrying Wagner chief Prigozhin after the break. But let's have a listen to Pilger now.
This is U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell of the United Nations, promoting the invasion of Iraq with an extraordinary theater of the absurd.
Iraq declared 8,500 liters of anthrax, but UNSCOM estimates that Saddam Hussein could have produced 25,000 liters.
Nothing of what he claimed was true. All these pictures were meaningless.
Saddam Hussein's intentions have never changed. He is not developing the missiles for self-defense. These are missiles that Iraq wants in order to project power, to threaten, and to deliver chemical, biological, and, if we let him, nuclear warheads.
Colin Powell's incredible performance was never seriously challenged in the American broadcast media, of which Rupert Murdoch's Fox Television is the biggest network. Like the rest of the Murdoch empire, it backed the invasion.
We expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up.
How do you steer this thing? I mean, you have a stick, is that right?
Sure, we have a both.
But the cartoon journalism of Fox can often overshadow the fact that the respectable media has played a critical part in promoting war. Like Fox, the celebrated New York Times published the false claims that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. The paper apologized to its readers 1 year later. In Britain, The Observer, another respected liberal newspaper, published the same false claims.
David, you've written about your articles in The Observer in the build-up to the Iraq invasion that you feel, and I quote you, nauseated, angry, and ashamed about what you wrote. What did you mean exactly?
It's now, and has been for a number of years, very painfully apparent that the facts that I believed to be true in those articles were not true. They were a pack of lies fed to me by a fairly sophisticated disinformation campaign.
But didn't it occur to you that these people were professional liars?
I overcame what should have been stronger doubts. I can make no excuses. I should have been more skeptical.
I mean, you finished off one of your articles by expressing almost a little editorial at the end, which you wrote that for the West, Iraq was, and I quote, an ideal place to establish a bridgehead. There are occasions in history, you wrote, when the use of force is both right and sensible. This is one of them. I mean, in essence, you were advocating an attack on a defenseless country. That's quite something, isn't it?
What has happened, the enormity of what has happened in Iraq, is far bigger than, you know, my own embarrassment, my own feelings. And what happened was a crime. It was a crime on a very large scale.
Does that make a journalist accomplices?
Yeah, broadly. Unwitting, perhaps, but yes.
This CBS News special report is part of our continuing coverage of America at War. Here is Dan Rabbit.
For 24 years, the most famous news anchor on American television was Dan Rather.
Your own career is remarkable for many things, but one of them in that you have stood up to power. Your questioning of Nixon, which I remember, back in 74, and also your interview over Irangate with Bush Sr. But then later on, you appeared famously on the David Letterman show, which I happened to see, and you said George Bush is the president, he makes the decisions, and you know, as just one American, wherever he wants me to line up, just tell me where and he'll make the call. Why did you say that?
This was in the almost immediate wake of 9/11. And that's the way I genuinely felt. I was responding as an American citizen in a personal way. And I have said that whether those of us in journalism want to admit it or not, then at least in some small way, fear is present in every newsroom in the country. A fear of losing your job, a fear of the institution, the company you work for going out of business, the fear of being stuck with some label, unpatriotic or otherwise, that you will have with you to your grave and beyond, the fear that there's so much at stake for the country that by doing what you deeply feel is your job will somehow be embarrassed. There's all of these things go into the mix, but it's very important for me to say, because I firmly believe it, I'm not the vice president in charge of excuses. That we shouldn't have excuses. What we should do is take a really good look at that period and learn from it.
So John Pilger there talking to several journalists about the Julian Assange case particularly, and just generally about propaganda. Assange, fresh hopes for the WikiLeaks founder as US Ambassador Caroline Kennedy flags a potential plea deal. Well, of course, this could easily be just a red herring because Julian is due to be extradited any time, isn't he? Any time now. We could hear it tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, I think she was slapped down, so she said that, and then Blinken said no, no, no. So, you know...
The possibility of him going to Australia, maybe.
Well, if they do a plea deal, but, I mean, various people have suggested that he shouldn't do a plea deal. He hasn't done anything, you know. And they're determined to get him. They're not going to give up. And it's across the board, you know. If Trump won the election, they'd still go ahead with it. It's very, very... sad for his family and for him, but it just shows the rank hypocrisy of the people leading the West when they complain about other countries suppressing dissent and all the rest of it. And you know, this guy is rotting in a maximum security prison. I mean, why put him in there? You know, he could be in an open prison, but they don't want to put him in an open prison because they're making an example of him so that people know what will happen.
Well, maybe maybe they think that someone will help him escape if he's in an open prison.
Well, I think that's most unlikely, don't you? You can make an open prison secure. You don't have to keep people in solitary confinement with the worst murderers in the country.
Well, no,
when he's a journalist, it's ridiculous.
It is torture, quite clearly, and it's one of the most, you know, it rings around the world as just a completely, well, it's a, you know, sign that Britain is a dictatorship and not a democracy, and a completely failed judicial system, particularly.
It's not a British dictatorship, it's a US dictatorship on British soil. That's what it is.
Are we even still an independent country, says Peter Hitchens. If we allow this, the Americans would certainly not let us treat them in this way. Do we think, he says, that the Biden White House will be nicer to us if we do their bidding over Julian Assange, or just even more contemptuous than they are already? As France's mighty Charles de Gaulle proved long ago, the Americans treat independent nations much better if they stand up to them than if they suck up to them.
Well, except that, of course, the British and the Americans tried to assassinate de Gaulle, so they didn't, you know, he didn't manage to get, I mean, and of course, Macron is in the pockets of the US. What's happening in Niger is quite interesting. Shostakovich's got an interesting take on it. He thinks that the coup plotters in Niger are actually working for the Americans to drive the French out of West Africa. Yeah, I'm just giving you his view, yeah? And that in actual fact, this is a limited hangout of what's going on there. He sees this as a power play by the Americans to remove the French from the situation in West Africa.
Well, so, yeah, so maybe the Americans are employing Wagner. Anyway, we'll be talking about that after the break.
Yeah.
And you're welcome to say what you just said again, if you want, afterwards. But I just thought, after we've heard a bit about Assange and a bit from John Pilger, why not go back? And this is a couple of months ago that he brought this out, but and I haven't used it since. I remember listening to it at the time, being really impressed by Pink Floyd's Roger Waters when he's talking about why he does what he does. And for some reason, Martin, I think the other members of Pink Floyd, and some of whom have obviously arrived after the initial Sid Barrett days of the band, they're being rather rude about Roger Waters, who seems to be the sort of singer-songwriter who's brought them most of their success. Why is that?
Well, I believe Dave Gilmour is married to a Ukrainian, so that's why he's like that. And, of course, he's a great guitarist, but he didn't write any of the songs, did he? That's Roger Waters who wrote the songs, isn't it?
Now, we'll hope, eventually, to open the eyes of ordinary people in England and in North America, those being the two places where I live, to the evils of the apartheid state of Israel, until such time as they moderate their ways and start abiding by this Bible, this one, Universal Declaration of Human Rights. When I see the army of thugs with their blue and white flags storming through the old city of Jerusalem on Flag Day, beating up any Palestinian who dares to be in their own street, shouting, kill the Arabs, kill the Arabs,
kill the Arabs, as they march through the street
with their Israeli flags. And nobody's going, oh, you can't say that. That's a hate crime. And it really is a hate crime, but there's nobody saying that. The police are there egging them on. So cancel culture is trying to get you to believe that in some weird way, my defense of the people of Palestine is more violent than the young thugs kicking Palestinians to death or the IDF soldiers shooting them through the heart with their sniper rifles like they did on the Great March of Return to that young Palestinian medic. Thousands upon thousands of them. These are just words. And these are my heartfelt, passionate words. A lot of my political ideals are fostered through this, mainly following my mother. She once said to me when I was struggling with something or other, she said, Roger, throughout your life, you're going to come up with all kinds of naughty problems, things that you have to wrestle with. This is my advice to you. Read, 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 and then read some more. Find out everything there is to know about whatever the question might be, however long it takes. When you've done that, you've done all the heavy lifting. The hard work is over. What do I do then, Mum? She said, next bit's easy. You just do the right thing. You know, it's not hard. But you do have to do the reading, and you cannot believe what the BBC tells you, because it's completely a mouthpiece of government and the ruling class. You are not being told any of the truth. So what I would suggest you should do is, like my mother would suggest you do, and read, read, read. And don't read the Daily Mail or the Guardian.
Well, I'm not quite sure what you're supposed to be. In fact, I would disagree on one point with Roger there, is you read all the newspapers. There is this sort of rather myopic view that you mustn't read the Daily Mail or you mustn't read the Guardian. Actually, all of these news outlets have things which are worth reading, don't they, Martin?
I think that's right, but of course you can't absorb everything. I've noticed in the last week, actually, various of the websites that I use to find out what's going on in the Ukraine have been taken down by the US servers, and they've had to New Eastern Outlook has had to reboot. South Front has been removed, has had to be but of course what it does is it gets rid of all. I used to have an article from New Eastern Outlook about the massacre in the Maidan Square, written by Christopher Black, and because the website had been taken down, I couldn't find it. But of course, I've managed to relocate it on the new website.
Yeah, WikiSpooks has had the same problems. So yeah. They've had to change their service providers, actually move country.
That's right.
This is happening quite a lot now, isn't it? So as the truth starts to pop up on the internet, so the NSA and GCHQ, I would imagine, plus maybe private agencies too, are using either legal actions or cyber attacks to do something about these websites, get rid of them.
That's right. It's called information warfare. And we have Brigade 77, 1,000 chaps and chapesses paid for by us.
Is it Chicksands that they're based up in Bedfordshire, I think?
I'm not sure whether they're based at Chicksands, because, of course, if we're 1,000 of them, they could be all over the place. It could be anywhere. The point is that they spend all day, every day, pretending to be people they're not on the internet and, basically trying to spin everything in their own way. And, RT is, people can't watch it in this country anymore. It didn't have a huge audience in the first place, but it now you can't even hear what they've got to say, because we are going to report to you.
Well, they did have a huge hang on. They did have a huge audience, actually. They'd overtaken the BBC by the time that they got taken down, as more people were actually watching RT around the world. But in half of the world, or the Western half, of course, it's completely impossible to get hold of any of that now. There is the Tor browser, which you can use to watch it. And I think it's Rumble, am I right? On Rumble, I think they've got their live stream. But you look at it and it's got about 300 or 400 people watching it.
Well, this is why they do this stuff. Because they know that if they make it difficult for people to access information, that slows everything down and they can push their line on whatever it is they want to push. And as Pilger pointed out, he's never seen this level of propaganda in all the time he's been in journalism. It is extraordinary. We are basically surrounded by absolute lies and disinformation.
So talking of which, we have the presidential debates, which we'll be looking at after news. But we have, it's not so much lies and disinformation, just utter corruption with King Charles, because when he was Prince Charles, he was caught red-handed with a massive suitcase full of cash, which he'd exchanged for a CBE or an OBE. It does amaze me, Martin. Why is it that people are prepared to pay so much money just to have one of these, honours, these gongs? Is it just pride, or what is going on there?
Well, I believe the Egyptian businessman we're talking about was promised that he would get two things. He would be made a knight, and he would also get British citizenship, so he can vote in our elections, etc.
Ah, right. So this is he'll become a legal migrant, not someone that's using the channel.
Well, don't forget, Tony, that the biggest migrants that have come to Britain in the last 18 months have come from the Ukraine, and there's loads of coming from Hong Kong. And of course,
I think some people are going back to Hong Kong, funnily enough, that they were believing the British propaganda about how scary it would be if China was running Hong Kong. And it hasn't actually been quite as bad as they thought.
Well, that may be so, but on the other hand,
Ukraine, you're right, though.
The policy of Suella Braverman is to bring in as many Ukrainians and Hong Kong Chinese as want to come.
But not Egyptians, so that's why he had
Mohammed Al-Fayed, of course, was famously, he bailed out the British Tory government in the crisis of the 1970s, and for that he got to buy Harrods and become a British citizen.
But he was actually a very decent chap, which is why, of course, his son was murdered by a certain chap we're about to hear about now.
The man who once reportedly used to squeeze the toothpaste onto the toothbrush of King Charles won't be investigated any further over reports of cash for honours. For 18 months, Scotland Yard has been looking into claims that Michael Fawcett, who rose through the ranks to become chief executive, what was then Prince Charles's foundation, promised a Saudi billionaire a knighthood in return for a huge donation. Today, detectives decided no further action is needed.
At the gates of Balmoral this morning, a royal tradition that has barely changed in decades. First, the bagpipes, and then a guard of honour for King Charles from the Royal Regiment of Scotland.
Arms!
It is the monarch's official summer welcome to the castle, but this monarch was today reminded of his time as Prince of Wales when police in London made a surprise announcement about one of his former aides. Michael Fawcett was a former valet who went on to run one of the big charities for the then Prince Charles. Mr. Fawcett, here holding the umbrella, was accused of offering to help a Saudi billionaire obtain a knighthood and British citizenship in return for donations, substantial ones, to the Prince's foundation. Mr. Fawcett subsequently stepped down and the matter was referred to police by the pressure group Republic.
If this was a politician, this would be all over the news and people would be asking very serious and searching questions.
Is your accusation that the police didn't do their job properly because of who was involved?
Not even speaking to Charles is appalling. I mean, that is a dereliction of duty. I mean, they seem very quick to arrest those who protest against royal corruption and very slow to deal with those who are accused of it.
Police say they did examine a letter Michael Fawcett was accused of writing to the Saudi donor, but this former employee of the king now knows he will not face any further police action. For the palace today, it was business as usual, despite the police announcement just minutes before the king stepped out in public. This was his first welcome to Balmoral as monarch, just as his mother had done before him.
What are you doing there?
Because summer here is supposed to be a moment to get away from the public gaze. Chris Hipp, News at 10, Balmoral.
So ITV did quite a good job of that. Of course, The presenter there is actually quite friendly with Prince Harry, and so he's also familiar with many of the things around the conspiracy to assassinate Princess Diana, which Charles will know all about, but of course is totally taboo. But anyway, Martin, what do you make of this? It's a Saudi businessman, a Saudi billionaire. I suppose the other question is, he says, if this was the Republic guy says, if this was a politician, well, actually, surely King Charles is a politician. He has very strong political views. He's not like his mum.
Well, the British monarch has always had strong political views. There's nothing new about that. In fact, most of the 18th and 19th centuries were about, you know, how much, let's say, they always.
Some do, some don't. I think his mum was actually quite, she obviously had views, but she allowed the politicians to get on with it most of the time, intervening occasionally, but much more of a hands-off approach. Here we've got a very hands-on approach where, Biden, for example, when he turns up in the UK, goes straight to Windsor Castle.
Yes, he's got much more hands-on approach than his mother, but his mother was unusual because her father definitely did have views. And, of course, we know that she has chosen, or she chose when she was alive, to stay out of politics. But there's no rule that says they've got to stay out of politics. Queen Victoria was very definitely Tory.
In a way, your head of state is kind of a chair, like a chair of an organisation, aren't they? And you get good chairs and you get bad chairs. A good chair will reflect the views around the table. A bad chair will tell people around the table what to think, and if someone around the table doesn't agree with them, then they'll get rid of them and find someone else that does.
Well, the Prince Philip, he had very decided political views, and they weren't Labour, let's put it that way, because he went to a German SS school as a teenager, of course, as many of the Saxe-Coburg Gothas did, and all the rest of it. Are we surprised by this? Of course we're not surprised.
Well, I am. I'm in a way quite surprised how brazen King Charles seems to be about his politics. And also, when they said in the report there, it's the first time he's been welcomed to Balmoral since his mother's death. We're just coming up next month to the anniversary of the death of the Queen, which was, I think, quite momentous in a way. It was like the death of an era, really, and everything now is moving on to this kind of postmodern, modernist, transhumanist world that we're being introduced to, which Charles seems to embrace, even though he's pretended not to for a long time, is the amazing piece of video film, in which I think we discussed on this program before, which is where one of the police, as King Charles is going into Balmoral, just after the death, or maybe as his mother was dying, there was the policeman gave a kind of one-eyed salute, just as the Range Rover containing he was still Prince Charles, I suppose, at that point. He hadn't been crowned king, is going in there. So there's this weird Masonic salute. And then also, someone has put together a very good little video about that, showing exactly what was going on and wondering what it is. I mean, obviously, I've spoken to police officers about it, and they tell me that it's very weird. It's not something that they're used to seeing, not a normal salute at all. But what I'll do is I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk a little video which takes you round Balmoral and discusses and shows you what this what actually happened when King Charles arrived at Balmoral at the time of, or just after, his mother's death. I found it all quite fascinating. And also, of course, two very, very good books, excellent books, one by Noel Botham, Who Killed Princess Diana, and the other one by John Morgan, How They Murdered Princess Diana, both authors dead. Another one for your bookshelf, folks. I think either or one or both of those, I think the John Morgan one is the much more comprehensive. But it makes it absolutely clear that Diana didn't die in an accident, Martin.
Yes, and I think it was carried out by the deep state, which just doesn't necessarily mean that the Prince of Wales, as he then was, would have been in the loop. He may have been, he may not have been.
Okay, so you know how these things work. If he hadn't have been in the loop, then he is possible he would have really kicked off about it if he didn't want Diana killed. But I think it's the way these things work is that anybody that might kick off, say, for example, a chief prosecutor, for example, a prime minister, a president, or someone in power at the time who had access to the media, those people would have to be somehow in the loop, wouldn't they? Certainly the Secret Services would have been, and Charles too. I think there was no love lost between them. I mean, when they were both alive, I witnessed them both face to face, and you could see very clearly that the actions of Princess Diana, Prince Charles, as he was at the time, absolutely hated her.
Yes, but if you remember, she was possibly pregnant with Dodi Alfayed's child, and she ruffled a lot of feathers with her campaigns about landmines. The deep state would have had their own reasons for removing her, and of course, Prince Charles himself wouldn't. What they would do?
Would they want Muslim half brothers for Harry? Well,
no,
and
they
William?
Wouldn't. No, these are the kinds of things we're talking about. And she might have come and spoken out about the Palestinians or stuff like this.
Well, she was actually beginning to.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So that this is, but to my mind, far more important than the more personal stuff, which obviously people concentrate on because they can understand that the deep state stuff is beyond their ken.
I suppose what we're talking about here is a kind of leadership that Charles seems to surround himself with sycophants and not suffer fools gladly. But maybe he sees opposition and criticism a bit like our Mayor Marvin Rees as a massive problem, and he can't deal with it.
Well, he's. People in his position, historically, have always been surrounded by sycophants. Louis XIV was surrounded by sycophants. That's the nature of monarchy. And, of course, some countries don't have monarchs, like Barbados.
Look, it's not just monarchy, is it? Come on, Biden. You know, it's nothing to do with monarchy. Well, generally, powerful people, they either choose to be surrounded by sycophants because they just... They don't like criticism, or else they will surround themselves with people who will be good critical friends, some intelligent ones, for example. I'm sure that someone like Putin, for example, he is not going to take criticism of his policies personally. I was reading a thing recently, I think it was watching a film on BitChute recently, about someone who knew Putin personally. I think he was speaking to Scott Ritter, and he was saying, actually, Putin wants to hear your point of view, and he doesn't want you necessarily to agree with him. And in fact, in the press, in the media, I can remember at the BBC, there was this, you know, amongst the people who've been there for many years, there was a complete disdain for the sycophantic types. And we wanted to hear criticism about programmes. We didn't want to hear someone coming along saying, oh, what a wonderful programme. And of course, what you've got now is you've got a culture in the mass media in this country, in many places, say, you know, the ITV Good Morning or This Morning, whatever it's called, where they're all slapping each other on the back and producing rubbish.
Well, it's... 'Twas ever thus, and it's getting worse. You're quite right about Putin. Putin is, in fact, a very skillful politician. He's a coalition builder. He's not somebody that gives orders. He talks
but
to everybody.
He's a bit like a king. He's been here a long time, hasn't he?
Well, he's a president. The presidential system in Russia was imposed by the West because the Duma, if you remember, led by Ruslan Khasbulatov, who was the prime minister, was opposed to the Chubais Gaidar shock therapy. And then Yeltsin shelled the parliament, killing hundreds of people, cheered on by the West. Everybody in Russia remembers this. People in the West don't remember that, do they? Where Yeltsin shelled the Russian parliament so that they could carry out a Thatcherite policy of putting everybody out of work in Russia. They remember this very, very well. People in the... And they made a strong presidential role for Yeltsin as a way of preventing democratic change in Russia. And, of course, what's happened... Putin has inherited that powerful presidency, which is probably stronger in some respects than the French presidency. But at the same time, the United Russia still have a bare majority in the Duma. So, you know, Putin's, it looked possible a couple of years ago that they might lose their overall majority. But if they did, they would just form alliances with other smaller parties. And because there's a broad consensus in Russia about what's happening in the Ukraine, nobody in the elected parliament is against the war in Ukraine. Some of them think Putin's not pursuing it vigorously enough, but most people are fairly satisfied he's not going to do anything stupid and he knows what he's doing.
Well, we're going to finish the first part with a little light piece from sort of thing that might have ended up, maybe it did, on Dialect years ago. which is from a chap called Lighthouse Bill. Now, Lighthouse Bill Shah, he's American-born and retired down in Portishead here, just on the Bristol Channel. And I had a chat with him last year, actually. It's been sitting around waiting there. I thought, what, you know, waiting for an opportunity to use it. But I rather love his take on this. And maybe we'll hear some comments from you, Martin, about his take on history. Here he is talking about the Norman invasion and then the Vikings and Hengist being based around Portbury, which is the big docks at the end of the River Avon here on the Bristol Channel. So over to Bill Shire and his take on the Norman invasion.
Bill Shire, immigrant from America, living in Portishead, and in order to save it from destruction, I've taken it on, formed a limited company, limited by guarantee, and made it into a community interest company to protect the lighthouse and to keep it for posterity.
So a lot of history here, pivoting around here.
We've been talking about the geology and the geology of the history, and we went into the people that lived here. This was a Viking area at one time, very heavily populated by the Vikings, the Godwinsons, and Harold Godwinson came from this area. He inherited the crown of England and went off to London, and then he had to fight his cousins, Harald Hardrada from Norway and William the Conqueror. And
so did he actually live around Portishead?
Yes, apparently they had a home in Portbury. That was a nice place for Bristolians to live, get fresh sea air, and in medieval times, before, it was rather uncomfortable to live in these smelly, stinky metropolitan areas. So they would have a summer home in Portbury, where the wives preferred that as opposed to living in Bristol. So the merchants in Bristol, so Fitzhardings and the Godwinsons, they kept a home in Portbury. That history goes back to Roman times. So this was an active area for Roman history, when they used to mine lead in the Mendips and take it down to a little port on the head of the creek, which became Portishead, and put the lead on barges and took it over the Carnion and Wales, and from there shipped it all over the Roman Empire. So the history of this area is incredible.
Well, I mean, you're from the United States originally. Some of these Vikings actually made it across the Atlantic as well.
Apparently so. They landed in North America, Canada, and had a colony there, but it didn't survive. It might have intermarried with the locals. But yes, they did. Leif Erikson did land in North America, start a colony, and they have remnants of the old dwellings and artifacts.
Okay, so what about Godwinson and other people, Hardrada, etc., who were hanging around here? Did they make it very far in their Viking ships around other parts of the world?
Oh, yes, Hardrada was a very adventurous person. Besides raping and pillaging, he explored vast areas of Russia and made it as far as down through Kiev. That you notice in the news, they mentioned the Rada in Kiev, where the senators get up and throw chairs at each other and tables, and that, those are Vikings. That was a Viking colony at one time. And Harald Hardrada went down to Istanbul and was a pirate for the Sultan, raping and pillaging and attacking ships on the Mediterranean Sea. And he heard his father died and his brother died shortly afterwards. The reason
it was his elder brother. Okay, so this could be quite significant if the elder brother dies in a royal family.
So that left the throne of Norway open to him, and he returned back to Norway and became the king of Norway. It was very comfortable, very rich farmland area just above Oslo. He's a very adventurous person. Then he heard there was a conflict in England with Harold the Edward the Confessor had passed away and left the throne of England in dispute. So he decided he'd have a go at that, and he came back down to England and met his cousin Godwinson from Portbury, and they had a terrible battle, heavy losses on both sides, and Harald Godwinson was victorious. So he rushed back to London, and then Hastings, where he had to defend his crown from William the Conqueror, and he lost that battle, which is monumental to England, the English history.
So we did the right guy win?
That's still open for discussion.
That's the lovely Bill Shire down at Portishead, Lighthouse Bill, he's known as. Martin, any factual errors you picked up on there?
Well, I think he's possibly, if he was here, he'd probably agree with me. Harald Hardrada did not work for the Sultan. Islam didn't exist at that stage, or it did exist, but it didn't exist there. It was called Constantinople, and he worked for the Byzantine Emperor. He was a mercenary for the Byzantines.
So, I mean, I didn't realise that there was this massive power struggle going on in England just before the Norman invasion. That makes it all very convenient for William, doesn't it?
Well, there were various claimants to the throne, and
because we did have periods of stability, but I mean, obviously, this is an enormous power struggle going on. It's not just that's not happening right throughout history. That was just literally just before the Norman invasion.
Well, that's right, because what had happened before that is that the Danes had been invading for years, and King Canute of Denmark became King of Britain, or King of England, as it then was. And of course he spoke Danish, and of course the Normans were themselves Danes, but they by the time they arrived they spoke French, but of course they were actually Norsemen. Actually Vikings,
Norsemen, yeah. As well. But so were they really Christians? I mean, they came across with their brand of Christianity, but some people say, well, actually they were Vikings, really.
Well, the Vikings and the Normans and the Anglo-Saxons all converted to Christianity during the early Middle Ages. You could say, are they Christians? But you could say, are they Christians in the style of John Wesley? Well, no, because John Wesley hadn't been born. It was hundreds of years ago before people like John Wesley
came along. Well, I'm not saying that. I'm saying, are they Christians? So, and also, of course, the same is true of the Roman Empire when they converted to Christianity. Anyway, thinking of which...
There is a meeting in there. Take care. aware of each other. When love walks in the room, everybody stand up. Like Brigitte Bardot. Now look at the people in the streets, in the bars. We are all of us in the gutter. Some of us are looking at the stars. Look round the room. Life is unkind. We fall, but we keep getting up. Over and over. Now the reason you're here, every man and every woman, is to help each other, stand by each other. When love walks in the room, everybody stand up.
Day, man, it's like these motherfuckers just like professional liars, you know what I'm saying? Wow. Listen, Bin Laden didn't blow up projects. It was your nigga. Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Tell the truth, nigga. Bin Laden didn't blow up projects. It was your nigga. Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Pledge no allegiance, nigga, fuck the president's speeches. I'm baptized by America and covered in leeches. The dirty water that bleaches your soul and your facial features. Drowning you with propaganda that they spit through the speakers. And if you speak about the evil that the government does, the Patriot Act to track you to the type in your blood. They try to frame you and say you was trying to sell drugs and throw a federal indictment on niggas to show you love. This shit is run by fake Christians, fake politicians. Look at their mansions and look at the conditions you live in. All they talk about is terrorism. Some on television, they tell you to listen, but they don't really tell you their mission. They funded Al-Qaeda, and now they blame the Muslim religion. Even though Bin Laden was a CIA tactician, they gave him billions of dollars, and they funded his purpose. Fahrenheit 9/11, that's just scratching the surface.
Bin Laden didn't blow up projects. It was your nigga. Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Tell the truth, nigga. Bin Laden didn't blow up projects. It was your nigga. Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Say the rebels in Iraq
like still fight for Saddam, but that's bullshit. I show you why it's totally wrong. Cause if another country invaded the hood tonight, it'd be warfare through Harlem and Washington Heights. I wouldn't be fighting for Bush or white America's dream. I'd be fighting for my people's survival and self-esteem. I wouldn't fight for racist churches from the south, my nigga. I'd be fighting to keep the occupation out, my nigga. You ever clock someone who talk shit but look at you wrong? Imagine if they shot at you and was raping your moms. And of course Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons. We sold them that shit after Ronald Reagan election. Mercenary contractors fighting a new era. Corporate military banking off the war on terror. They controlling the ghetto with the fear of attack. Trying to distract the fact that they engineering the crack. So I'm strapped like Lee Malvo holding a sniper rifle. These bullets will touch your kids, and I don't mean like Michael. Your body be sent to the morgue, stripped down and recycled. I fire on house niggas that support you and like you. Cause innocent people get murdered in the struggle daily, and poor people never get shit and struggle daily. This ain't no alien conspiracy theory, this shit is real. Written on a dollar underneath the Masonic seal.
Now I don't rap for dead presidents, I'd rather see the president dead. It's never been said, but I set precedents.
Bin Laden blow up the projects. It was your nigga. Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Tell the truth, nigga. Bin Laden blow up the projects. It was your nigga. Tell the truth,
City
nigga.
City Records was 80 seconds away from the tower. Some cowards fought with the phone building. They meant to hit hours.
Well, Immortal Technique there, with Mos Def. That is from, well, the 9/11 Truth era, Martin, isn't it? It must be at least a decade ago. Yeah, apologies for the swearing there, but I think it's a little bit of swearing, but I think it's, you know, some of this rap, it's really worth it. And if it's just gratuitous, it's awful, but he does a fantastic job. Just in that song, Martin, well, it's one thing he's saying, Bush knocked down the towers. That's the only, you know, sort of slight criticism I'd have of the song. Is it certainly wasn't George Bush, was it? George Bush.
Well, George Jr. Bush, George Bush Jr. was a factotum in the whole thing. Cheney.
He was threatened, wasn't he? Actually, on the day. You know, he was told, you know, that if you don't do X, Y, and Z, we're going to shoot the American president's plane down.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you wouldn't put somebody like George W. Bush in charge of anything, really.
Like Biden, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, well, yes, or like Reagan. But Cheney, of course, knew exactly what was going on, because he was the one that ordered not to shoot down the planes as they were coming into the Pentagon.
And before that, we had Joe and Eddie with There Is a Meeting Here Tonight from 1964. A rather groovy jazz tune. That's the Funky Express, and that's from the Sweeney album, soundtrack of the Sweeney. And Chrissy Hyde and the Pretenders, Message of Love, too. Something we don't hear hardly anything of on the radio. Why is that? Fantastic song. Absolutely wonderful song. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Martin Summers. That is Old Labour. Old Labour. What are you, Martin?
Well, you used to call me Old Labour Oxford Economist, and then you decided that I was an Irish Republican.
Well, you are, kind of, aren't you, really? I think that's more Old Labour. It's a bit old hat now, because it's been New Labour for far too long. Anyway, so, and me, Tony Gosling. So, first of all, just to announce our winner of our competition from last week. I'm not sure how often I'm going to do this, but, yeah, so thanks very much, to, Douglas White, from Steel End in Fife. And he starts his letter to me, "All right, Terry." Look, okay, Douglas. You've got a bit of a crazy sense of humour. I'm not sure what you called Martin, but it wasn't Martin. So he's saying quite correctly that, both songs were composed by Burt Bacharach, with lyrics by Hal David. So, pretty simple answer there. Also, another link is Deanne Warwick here. So he's informing us now. She recorded You'll Never Get to Heaven before the Stylistics did, the song we played last week. And she was originally offered What the World Needs Now, but she turned it down at the time, and they recorded a version of it later. Listen, I don't know if you're a DJ, Dougie, but yeah, so anyway, your book's on its way in the post to you very, very soon. So thanks very much for bothering to enter our competition, and we'll have other ones in the future, I'm quite sure. The other thing, of course, we must do this week is read out the this week's poem from Patrizia Opulenza before we get stuck into Prigozhin. And this week it is, what is it, which one is it? Oh, yes. Slam Gunk, a.k.a. JVT, a.k.a. DVT. So, Van Slam, this is Jonathan Van Tam, okay, folks, the guy who's gone to work for Moderna after being a so-called government plandemic engineer. So, Van Slam Gunk is on the prowl. A new job, he now begins. A lardy-looking bully on face see all his sins. For his dodgy monologues throughout the Convid scam, revolving doors now swinging for a big-bellied Van the Man. A nasal sound here in his voice when talking up the sham. Bully beef, perhaps, he was at school, and then henceforth. He thinks he's riding high these days, and his career is now on course. But no life worth ever living can be lived with any ease when that life is rotten to the core or putrid and diseased. So, Van Tam, have a nice time at Moderna. And I think we have also have to look at all of our politicians and think, well, where are they being offered jobs whilst they're crookedly destroying the country and killing people? Professor David Hughes, who's been on this program a couple of times now, but he explained that there's something weird in these jabs and looked at photographs from all over the world, and a crime against humanity. That's what he said the pandemic was, or the plandemic, as we call it here. Anyway, Martin, the death of Yevgeny Prigozhin, the boss of Wagner, is being absolutely spun amazingly, I think, here in the West and in the UK, something that the Russian Vladimir Putin has done. Now, every time we see some sort of attack within Russia, say the Kremlin is being blown up, that we're being told that this is Russia is doing it to themselves, apparently. And apparently this is what's happened, is Putin is the most likely person to have killed Prigozhin.
Well, of course, the Ukrainian SBU and their British and US sponsors have been carrying out terrorist attacks inside the Russian Federation for some while. Dugin's daughter was assassinated with a car bomb. Givi and Motorola were killed in Donbass in 2017, I think it was, and the same as was Zakarchenko, who was the elected prime minister of the Donbass. So they're losing the Clausewitzian war on the front line, where their soldiers are just being completely destroyed. But they've got this Sun Tzu type of war, where they creep around carrying out psychological warfare and,
try and manipulate the public and manipulate the news.
Yeah, and also they do kill people, but it's, you know, the most likely suspects for blowing up Prigozhin's plane are the Western stay-behind teams that the MI6 have been creating. You know, they boast about, we've got these stay-behind teams in Russia. You know, we've blown up a railway station. We've blown up a big Air Force jet that was blown up in Siberia. And this, of course, is MI6. We're paying for this.
Anyway, Russian President Vladimir Putin has made some comments today on the Prigozhin plane crash. He said he made serious mistakes in his life, but he also achieved results. Actually, this is yesterday, isn't it? Mm-hmm. He also achieved results. Tell us a bit about Wagner. Isn't it just a kind of Russian version which grew up in the wake of Blackwater and XE and Eric Prince's outfit? A similar kind of organisation, well, at arm's length. In a way, a little bit like Elizabeth I's privateers, you know, something where they can say, oh, this is terrible what they've done, nothing to do with us. But actually, of course, they are.
Well, Utkin, who also died in the plane crash, if what we're hearing is right, his call sign, as he was working in the Donbass to organise resistance to the anti-terrorist operation of the Ukrainian army, was Wagner. And that's where the name comes from. But Utkin is, in fact, a soldier, special forces soldier from the Russian special forces. Prigozhin is basically an oligarch. He's got no military experience at all. I think the police in Russia are treating this as suspicious. And I think that what Putin will do with this is he will just let the police look into it and find out who did it.
Yeah, so anyway, I spoke earlier today to the former hedge fund manager and the author of the book on the Magnitsky Act, Alex Craner, about this and see what he made of it all.
My own sense is that if we're looking at an assassination, then I would suspect that it's more likely that it's a Western orchestrated assassination. So, you know, my top of my list of suspect would be MI6 and CIA, probably.
A couple of things.
Yes,
to say,
go ahead, please.
Is that in the initial news coverage there was discussion of people seeing some sort of smoke plume. Apparently that this could be some sort of missile that had hit the aircraft. Certainly, it looks as if the tail high up got detached completely from the rest of the aircraft because they both came down separately, which suggests either it was a missile that hit the rear end of the aircraft or else, which is the engines, presumably, in this jet, which could be a heat-seeking missile of some sort. But the other thing is, apparently, there was a big load of wine which was put on wherever it took off from, which could potentially have contained a bomb. But anyway, the point is, tell us a little bit about Wagner and why it might be, because it seems to me that they would have to be, MI6 or the CIA would have to actually be in Russia to do this sort of an operation if it was them, and why it might be them.
Well, because I suspect that most of what we know about Prigozhin's little coup stunt from 2 months ago was actually an orchestrated diversion between Prigozhin, Vladimir Putin, and the defense minister Shoigu. I don't think that the coup was genuine at all, because the whole thing was quite preposterous. Namely, at the time, Prigozhin has been ranting against his superiors in the Russian, military command and control hierarchy for weeks. That, in war conditions, that is absolutely that cannot be tolerated. I've served in the military during the wartime, and this is just simply unimaginable. The fact that he was able to get away with it, that he wasn't made an example of and punished straight away by, at the very least, being stripped of his command and probably prosecuted and court-martialed, tells me that was all intended probably to serve as a magnet for would-be fifth column coup organizers or assassinations, people who might organize the assassination attempt against Vladimir Putin. Because let's face it, the Russia's Achilles heel is Vladimir Putin. So if there were going to be a successful attempt on his life, that could potentially undo everything in favor of the Western alliance. So I think that he was the point man to attract such would-be, let's say, assassins or people who might order the assassination, both internally and externally. And I think that this made him very valuable, and this is why he remained as the chief of Wagner and why he was allowed to simply set himself up in Belarus, but nevertheless travel as pleased in and out of Russia to Africa and back, meet with African leaders at the St. Petersburg Russia-Africa summit. None of that would be possible if he were really the traitor to the Russian cause. And so I think that he remained in power. Part of the reason is to provide forms of support to the African regimes that are now, fighting for their independence from the Western colonizers, like France, United Kingdom, United States. And I think that this is why the Western powers might want him and his, apparently this one plane crash took out the whole top level management of Wagner. And so I think that the side that benefits potentially from this is the Western powers.
I mean, the West has been running these kind of private armies for a long time, the private military companies like XE Blackwater with Eric Prince, hasn't it? I mean, in a way, the Russians have sort of caught up with Wagner, haven't they?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think it's probably a convenient thing if you need to take action in a more agile and nimble way without having to justify the expenditure and the action to the, you know, to the parliament at home. You have a way of plausible deniability. Like if something goes wrong, you can say, oh, well, you know, these people were acting on their own behalf. They were rogue actors. They're not fully under our control and so forth. It's probably convenient. It's probably very effective as well. And I think that this is one of the reasons why Western powers might have wanted to behead the Wagner organization.
Do you think it will really affect operations much? Surely what happens is junior officers will now be promoted and now be running it.
Well, I think that it might have serious impact, and the reason is that Yevgeny Prigozhin was obviously a person of very high, he had very high degree of confidence from Vladimir Putin. Recall, he was essentially nobody, like a small-time businessman in Russia and, you know, operating at the edge of legality. He ended up in prison as well. But then somehow he found himself as the person who is serving Vladimir Putin food. And the dignitaries inviting him. So he was, you know, he got the nickname Putin's chef. Well, that's extremely, extremely delicate position because you are in a position to poison people, you know. You could. So, to be in that position, Vladimir Putin obviously had to have very high degree of confidence in Prigozhin. And then he advances from being his chef to being the chief of this military organization that operates outside of the regular Russian armed forces. Again, all of this confirms that he's a very important person. And I think that with him eliminated, you will have to find a replacement. But, you know, it could be that finding a replacement who enjoys such a high degree of confidence could be difficult.
Yeah, it's just a lot of it.
And, you know, there's
trust, isn't it? But anyway, I mean, most people know what Wagner has achieved in the east and southeast of Ukraine. But what about their role over in Africa? Because there's been some, I mean, if you think about the amount of territory involved, I mean, Niger, for example, is enormous. And it's quite clear that Wagner were very much involved in that successful coup. The West has been trying to counter it, but it hasn't really been able to persuade other African, even pro-West African leaders to weigh in.
Obviously, you know, I think that unlike in the past, because we have seen that the ECOWAS and, you know, by ECOWAS, pretty much the country that runs the show is Nigeria. They have fielded many military assaults against governments in the region to undo coups or to install somebody favorable to the West in those countries. And this time around, they're clearly feeling extremely reluctant. There's obviously, you know, the geopolitical equation has changed. And I cannot say whether this is due to Wagner's presence, but I think that Wagner is one of the big elements in that region that is new and different. And so it may be that Wagner is actually what's inhibiting the kind of action and reaction to coups that we've seen over the last several decades. And so I think that might have made Prigozhin a target, you know, because to behead Wagner and to, you know, cause them to disarray, or maybe, you know, get a different kind of management who might be less capable, more easily bought, gives a soft entry to the West. You know, these operations in Africa expose Russia to vulnerability, you know, because whoever is operating in Russia will come into contact with Western intelligence operations, military organizations, who might be able to buy them and use them as a Trojan horse to then run sabotage operations in Russia. So this is extremely delicate.
Alex Craner there, and the full version of that will be up on our show page tonight, God willing, at thisweek.org.uk. Alex's analysis is excellent, and it, very interesting what he was saying about June's so-called, like, 48, was it? No, it was a 20-hour rebellion by Wagner, apparently. What he's saying there is that what was really going on was that the idea was to flush out in the Russian military and in the Russian administration around the country anybody that might jump on the bandwagon thinking, oh, great, a coup, I'm going to help with this, and a rebellion, I'm going to help with this. And so to find out who was really loyal to the Kremlin and who wasn't, and that would paint a whole nother picture of that. And in a way, you don't get rebellions that last for less than a day, really. You know, it did seem that it was a bit theatrical.
Well, I read a lot about this, and there's all sorts of theories floating around out there. I think it might be significant that the Surovikin has been removed, because it's possible that he was supportive of Prigozhin's attempted coup.
Pretend coup. I mean, I think we
all
should
right,
maybe
well,
say.
Okay.
I mean, you know, in a way, I think that's, it didn't really ever seem to kind of get going.
All right, well, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to keep an open mind about these things,
yeah,
because
it's
complicated, isn't
but we
it?
Don't get, we're not getting this analysis that Alex given us at all in the West here, are we?
No, we're not. I mean, what the Western media have immediately plunked, oh, well, it's obviously Putin, because, you know, he poisoned Skripal, he killed
Litvinenko.
Yeah,
rubbish.
Yeah. I mean, Boris Nemtsov, for example, the assassination of Boris Nemtsov some years ago now. Now, Boris Nemtsov
on a bridge, this guy,
was a liberal politician. Yeah, he didn't have a lot of support in Russia, but he was definitely,
he was actually taking money from the West.
You see, he was a pro-Western politician.
Hang on, no, he was, just a minute, no, I remember this now, you talk not about Nemtsov, sorry to talk over you, but he was a liberal politician, a quite pro-Western Yeltsinite politician, who had spoken out against other similar people campaigning in Russia's politics, who had been taking money from the West.
Nemtsov was definitely not a supporter of Putin. He came to Moscow and he was murdered on the steps of the Kremlin. And what the Russian authorities did was quite clear. They checked all the CCTV, talking about CCTV, Tony. The CCTV showed that he'd been followed, and they got the people who shot him, they got the people who gave the orders, and then the trail went back to Chechnya, and then the trail ran cold. And he, Nemtsov, pro-Western, assassinated on the steps of the Kremlin by MI6.
It wasn't
CIA.
Quite on the steps of the Kremlin. It was on a bridge, wasn't it?
Yes,
over the river, next to the Kremlin.
I mean, if, for example, Putin wanted to get rid of Prigozhin, he wouldn't do it by blowing up a plane over countryside in Moscow, outside Moscow. There must be loads of different ways to get rid of people, and that's not what you'd do.
And it's interesting also that he was Prigozhin was up at the Africa summit in a couple of weeks ago up in St. Petersburg.
Yes. And of course,
it's where these coups have been going.
At one stage, I mean, one of the theories that's been circulating, and I'll just put it down for the sake of completeness, is that the Prigozhin coup, we understand, again, we've got, it's a question
you
of.
You mean in Niger?
No. In,
oh, right, 2 months ago.
Yeah,
okay.
They shot down 11 pilots of the Russian Air Force as part of what was going on. And it's possible that people in the Air Force have decided to take, you know, to sort Prigozhin out, because they weren't happy about that, because he was let off. Now, I think there's still loads of mysteries about this. It may be that Prigozhin was a double agent, a triple agent, or goodness knows what. But I don't think that there's another interesting factual thing to do with what happened with the plane, which is that the stewardess, because there was a stewardess on board, she phoned her parents and said, we're having some emergency repairs to the undercarriage. and that they were 15 minutes late taking off because some emergency repairs had been, and it looks as if that may be where the bomb was.
Well, now, the bomb, okay, so it could be, but also...
Yes, I know about the wine, but the wine had gone on board, and then the sniffer dogs came and sniffed the wine. But after the wine had been brought on board, there was then another...
Maybe the sniffer dogs were agents.
Well, it's a question of...
That the tail detached does suggest that either it's something in the hold or else it's a heat-seeking missile. These jets have got engines at the back of them.
Now, I think the way the Russian authorities will approach this is play a straight bat. The police are investigating it. There'll be forensics will look into it. Now, if it is the Air Force doing that without consulting Putin, they shouldn't do that. Yeah, but I don't think it is. It's more likely to be the SBU, the Ukrainian secret police, because don't forget...
What about MI6 and CIA?
Well, they will have helped as well. But the SBU have definitely got a motive because Prigozhin's Wagner killed tens of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers in Artemyovsk, as we must now call it. So we've got Kiev and we've got Artemyovsk. It's not Bakhmut. It's Artemyovsk. That's the Russian name. But they killed thousands and thousands and thousands of Ukrainian conscripts there. So they've got a very good, I imagine they would regard Prigozhin as a fair target.
What about this link to the coup in Niger? Because we're going to play another clip now. This is from Netfu Freeman from the Black Alliance in the United States talking about what's been going on over in Niger. And we'll get your comments, because this is one of the things I think has been particularly difficult for the West, is that even though there's been this coup... it's a massive country, Niger, where you've got resources of gold, lithium, uranium, and obviously it's one of those really colossal countries. It's not just a little tiny place. And this is something where the West has been trying to convince neighbouring countries to take military action against the coup leaders, but they fail completely. So that may be part of the reason to get rid of Prigozhin. But anyway, let's have a listen now to... Netu Freeman. You won't be hearing him on British television talking about what he thinks about this coup in Niger for the Black Alliance.
The people in Africa, are, and particularly in the formerly French colonies, are fed up with neocolonialism, particularly French neocolonialism, and they can see after movements that are trying to overthrow the boot on their neck of the imposition of the CFA franc, the imposition of control of their military, the imposition of control of their land and extractive industries, particularly like uranium, their people are tired of that. Now, we also are looking at a situation where we would call it an emboldened military class is also not, we can't negate the effect that these movements for self-determination are having on the military class. Some would say, well, this is not necessarily a revolutionary movement, but we're not claiming that it is, but we can't negate that the movements and the aspirations and the call of the people has an effect on the situation there. That's why the people embrace what's happening. And it's just not just happened in Niger. We know that it's happened in other countries in the Sahel, Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali in particular, and that what should be referred to as the comprador class, those people, particularly those countries and leaders who are making up ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, are trying to hold on to their situation. They're taking their orders, and the imperialist countries, France and the United States, are threatened by what's happening, and that they will, as we've seen all around the world, that they will stop at nothing, even military invasion, to do so. They don't want to do it themselves. They'd rather not do it themselves, so they deploy, as they're even doing, they're deploying the African formations like ECOWAS to make this threat. So, they're worried.
Yeah, so that is, Netu Freeman, and he's part of something called the Black Alliance over in the United States. Obviously, it's Black Alliance for Peace. Talking about Niger there, but I mean, what he's saying is this is a release from neocolonialism. That's what's actually going on in Niger, and of course, there is a lot of anger in the West, particularly with these big mining companies, etc., that will be wanting to mine that uranium and the lithium and the gold in Niger.
Yes, and of course there have been several coups. Prigozhin hasn't been in Niger. He was in Mali like the other week before he got topped in Russia.
Well, we don't know that, do we? We don't know whether he's been there or not.
No, he was in Mali because he gave you know, he was on YouTube talking or whatever it is from Mali. But that's because Mali has had a coup already.
Yes.
So are various countries which has already had military coups, and what they're really opposed to is the, as he's mentioned there, the CFA franc. So that France itself uses the euro, but they insist that all of their former colonies use the French franc, which only exists for use in these colonies, and they've got to keep all of their reserves in the Bank of France.
It may have been Mali, we may well be right, but apparently it was undisclosed which country that he was speaking from, and it was recorded, I think, the day before or the morning that he died, Prigozhin. Wagner and the Russian state conspired, apparently, to facilitate the military coup in Niger, a former Russian official claimed, after the mercenary chief released a video message from an undisclosed African country, his first since leading a failed uprising in June. The recent coup in Niger was carried out in close cooperation with Russian special forces and the private military companies, claimed Russian military blogger Mikhail Zivinuk, a former press officer for Russia's defense ministry, who has the alias Rybar. Is that? Yeah, Rybar, whatever that means. Anyway, this cooperation between Russia and Wagner meant it was extremely reckless to talk about any severing of ties following the mutiny, the blogger claimed. A military junta took power in Niger last month, overthrowing the government of President Mohamed Bazoum, keeping him under house arrest at the president's residence in capital city Niamey. The coup was condemned by regional and international powers, which have imposed sanctions and threatened military action, but none so far has taken place. And I think that it's fair to say that many of the neighbouring African countries are starting to lose confidence in the Americans' ability to control that part of the world.
Well, the French and the Americans are allies in one way, and in other ways they are in competition to control that part of the world. And don't forget, a lot of the problems that have been caused in the Sahel is because we overthrew the government of Libya and created an ungoverned space. The Libyan army's weaponry, for example, fell into the hands of all these jihadist groups, which are now causing all the chaos in the rural areas.
So it does present us with a pretty powerful motive for the assassination of the Wagner boss, doesn't it? As the United States or and other powers are looking around saying, well, actually, we can't actually do anything about this coup, it doesn't look like. I mean, this is the sort of thing the Yanks have been doing for a long time, isn't it, with Eric Prince and Blackwater?
Well, and the French have been intervening in this area continuously since the 19th century. This is what's causing a lot of younger generation in these countries to say we're fed up of being told what to do by the French. Yeah. And we don't really want the Americans here either.
In a way, it's kind of payback time for all of the lies that have been being told ever since, well, certainly since the 1970s, but particularly since 9/11, the war on terror, is that basically the American brand is tainted and doesn't command any confidence anymore. And we also had this week the Tucker Carlson debate with Donald Trump. So we're going to hear a little clip from that now, where he talks about how America under Biden is losing a lot of its influence in Latin America.
When somebody gets indicted, your poll numbers go down. When somebody gets indicted, you announce, ladies and gentlemen, I'll be leaving to spend time with my family and to fight for the rest of my life on this stuff. But you're out of politics. I got indicted 4 times. All trivia, nonsense, bullshit. It's all bullshit. It's horrible when you look and you look at what they're doing. The boxes hoax, I'm covered by the Presidential Records Act. I'm allowed to do exactly that. He's not covered, and he's got 25 times the number of boxes. And he's got them stored in Chinatown. He's got them stored in a flimsy garage underneath his Corvette. At Penn, and by the way, at Penn he gets millions of dollars. China pays this guy millions of dollars. See, I think he's the most corrupt president we've ever had, and he also has the distinction of being the most incompetent. And I believe both. I mean, he's both incompetent and corrupt.
So
I actually believe he's compromised because China knows so much about him. They know where the money comes from. They know where it is, who paid it, and they probably paid it. Well, they do pay Penn, and he gets $1 million. I think it takes $999,000 because, you know, keeps it a little bit under a million, like by a dollar. But he, in many ways, is a Manchurian candidate. We have a Manchurian candidate, and he's afraid to tell Russia to get out of Cuba. He's afraid to tell China to get out of Cuba. He's afraid. China now is building, think of this, China's building military installations in Cuba. The Cuban population of Miami is not too happy because they're never going to be able to go back. And you don't even hear about it. And the worst culprit is the press, the media, because normally, you know, when I first heard that, that China's building installations in Cuba, and installations means military installations, okay, you know, they said just some communication. They did that on the islands with Japan. They took the island, they started this massive construction, and they told everybody, including the Japanese have to be very careful, they told everybody that this is a housing development. They're going to build a housing development. And I said, how come the runway is 20,000 feet long? You know, private jets need 4,000 feet. They don't need 20,000 feet. The big ones need 20,000 feet. They don't even need 20. And I looked at the runway. I said, that's the largest runway ever built, both in width and length, for housing development. There's nobody that has a plane that big that you would have a runway that's
why
that's
is China testing. Allowed to conduct imperialism in our hemisphere?
Well, yeah, and it's far beyond Cuba. It's all over South America.
Yeah, in the Caribbean.
So we built a thing called the Panama Canal. We lost 35,000 people to the mosquito, you know, malaria.
Yeah.
We lost 35,000 people building. We lost 35,000 people because of the mosquito. Vicious. They had to build under nets. It was one of the true great wonders of the world, as he said, one of the nine wonders of the world. No, it was one of the seven. This happened a little while ago, you know. It says nine wonders of the world. You could make nine wonders. He would have been better off if he stuck with the nine and just said, yeah, I think it's nine. But this is one of the true seven wonders of the world. And you take a look at the Panama Canal. It was such an incredible engineering marvel. We sold it under Jimmy Carter. We sold it to Panama for $1. The following day, they quadrupled the amount of money the ships had to pay to get across. They didn't lose one ship. And now they've made it much bigger, and now they've widened it. They've doubled it, right? They've more than doubled it. And it's one of the most profitable things. Any time, it's just incredible, right? We gave it away for $1. China now controls it. They actually control the Panama Canal. They run it. They control it. And we shouldn't let that happen. And we can't let China be in Cuba. And they'll get out. If I'm president, they'll get out.
I suppose that means because Donald Trump will threaten them with nuking them, Martin, if they don't get out. But, you know, it's interesting. This sort of thing isn't really being discussed in the main debates, is it? The more Trump is talking about there is the complete flat. Well, I mean, the sagging of the American empire, even on its own doorstep.
Well, I mean, the arrogance of the Americans, including Trump and Biden and all the rest of them, is extraordinary. China is actually completely surrounded by US military bases. Okinawa, the Philippines, they're right in
their
face.
There's echoes of the Cuban Missile Crisis here, aren't there? Because the Americans put their, with Jupiter missiles, wasn't it, into
Turkey.
Yeah. And that was what precipitated the crisis. So the Americans are putting their military might behind Taiwan, apparently. And so the Chinese are saying, well, if you can do that, well, we're going to do the opposite.
Well, yes, and it's not even clear that the Chinese are in Cuba. The Cubans' main allies are the Russians. They were never particularly aligned with the Chinese. And, of course, the attitude that the Americans have, that Latin America belongs to them. They think it does. They've overthrown all sorts of democratic governments. They're still doing it. The government in Peru, I've forgotten the name of the guy, has been removed. And the American military are there making sure he doesn't come back. And that is, they just take the view that they could dominate all these countries. And that they can't, I mean, what they said about the Ukraine is that Ukraine should be allowed to join NATO because anybody can join any alliances they want. So the Cubans want to join an alliance with the Chinese. Who are the Americans to tell the Cubans what to do? And don't forget, you've got all these Cuban refugees in Miami. How did they get into the country? They got into the country because they're against America's enemies. So they get a free entry to the United States, and they run a lot of the politics in Florida, even though they're not from Florida.
Anyway,
and of course, if you came from Haiti in a small boat, you'd be sent straight back, because that's a real Trump used to call shithole of a country, and it's a shithole of a country because the Americans have made it so over many, many years.
So we're going to go back to Ukraine now, finally, almost finally anyway, and hear from Andrei Kochetov. Now, he's a union leader over in the Donbass. That is the Democratic People's Republic. What is it called? DNP?
Well, it's not called. It's called because of it, they've all joined
part of the Russian Federation.
Yeah, so they've changed the name.
So they got four regions basically of Ukraine, ex-Ukraine, that are now actually part of the Russian Federation, which is where he lives in Lugansk. Do you want to say a bit about that? I mean, Lugansk is actually more protected. It's further from the front lines, isn't it?
Well, Donetsk. I can't remember whether they say Lugansk or Luhansk. I can't remember because it's one
is... He might even say it for us.
Yes.
So, anyway, let's have a listen to him now. I managed to get him on the line earlier this week. I just think, you know, when I'm not hearing anything from Ukrainians who actually...
He's not a Ukrainian.
He is Ukrainian. Can you please just let me finish? He is Ukrainian.
No,
he's born in Ukraine, and he considers himself a Ukrainian that is against Zelensky.
Well, he's now living in the Donbass, which is part of Russia, so his citizenship is
Russian. Well,
he's Ukrainian.
He is a Ukrainian. He's brought up in Ukraine, and he thinks of himself as Ukrainian, but he doesn't recognise Kiev as the proper government of Ukraine. Anyway, let's have a listen to him, Martin.
In my trade union, 5,000 and half.
Okay, and what is your union representing? What kind of workers?
For example, their factory which produce water, the factory which produce, which connecting to the metal industry, also metal workers, and so on.
Okay, so can you just say the name of the union in Russian?
Профсоюз инновационных и малых предприятий.
Okay, it's a bit of a mouthful for anyone in English, but anyway, look, take us.
Innovative and small enterprises.
Okay. Well, anyway, can you take us through your journey since 2014, please? What's been going on in your life?
It was a war against, as for me, it was a civil war against the central government, against the region of Donbass, because the people of Donbass just said they wanted to be, listened by government. But for government, as it turned out, it was much easier to use a regular army against our people.
So why was the Donbass, the southeast region of Ukraine, why was it that they didn't want to accept the new government after the coup? Why that region?
You see, it was not immediately, but from the first so-called Maidan, which took part in the 2004, and the President Yushchenko, he divided in his slogan the country. The biggest part, this is the real and good Ukrainians, and eastern part of Ukraine, bad Ukrainians, because they people of Russian culture. You see, from the Soviet Union, it was the very big industrial region. And after the Second World War, the government invite people from other regions of the Soviet Union to Donbass to work, to rise up the industry of the Soviet Union. And that's why it's this region is multinational. And that's why you see it was always... a little different part of Ukraine, but As for me and many people, we use Ukrainian language, we use Ukrainian habits, and without any problem. More of this, in the Soviet time, we study Ukrainian language in our schools without any problem. So as for me, I think that it was... Yushchenko prepared the future attack against the people of Donbass, as for me. Because now I understand that before 2004, I never heard about that Donbass is something strange for the rest part of Ukraine or something like that. But now the situation, not now, but after the Yushchenko announcement, they step by step, day by day, they started to say that Donbass people is not good Ukrainians. And in 2014, the people rise up and said, please, listen to us. We are the Ukrainian people. But as I told you that they decided to fight against us by regular army. Yes?
Yes, so can you tell us about that experience? That must have been rather worrying to have the army turning up instead of the police.
You see, it was a big fake. Because, you know, they called the military operation as the anti-terroristic operation. It was especially for the people of Western countries, because many people decided that operation against terrorism, it means that police air forces and try to find some terrorists and so on. But they never said that they use a real army with tanks, with aircrafts, and so on. So, as for me, it was they play tricks with governments of Western countries. You know that many people from other countries came to Ukraine to support Maidan and so on and so on.
When he's talking about other countries, he's saying it wasn't just Ukrainians on that Maidan protest that precipitated the coup.
No, it wasn't. And of course, the snipers that carried out the massacre were 50 of them, 48 Georgians and 2 Lithuanians. So they weren't even Ukrainians who are the ones who carried out the massacre. And, you know, there's been a court case in Kiev in 2017 where the Berkut riot police were basically found not guilty of the massacre, and two snipers from Georgia testified on video that they had carried out the massacre. And it was very suspicious in 2014 because Umas Piets, the Estonian foreign minister, phoned up Catherine Ashton, ex-Labour politician who was the EU's foreign affairs head, and he told her, I've just been going around the hospitals, all these people have been shot, the protesters and police officers have all been shot in the head with the same rounds. It's an orchestrated provocation, and it's been carried out by people close to the new government, not the previous government.
I mean, we pontificate away here week after week about Ukraine, but it's actually quite useful to hear someone based in Lugansk, a trade union leader, give his point of view as well.
We don't hear their point of view at all.
It's totally sensitive,
through the whole of the 2014 to 2022 situation, they were being under shelling. Millions of people have fled from the eastern Ukraine to Russia because the situation has been dire for years and years and years.
The Maidan coup happened when the West took over in 2014 in Kiev, The one of the main sponsors of that is one of the oligarchs of he's a joint Israeli. Can you remind me of his name? That oligarch that financed the coup. I will remember it in a minute. But anyway, that was in February 2014. It's not Kolomoisk. There are quite a few.
No, you're thinking of Pinchuk.
Victor Pinchuk. That's the guy.
Yeah, but I mean, they're all in on it.
It was his people that did it. He had his own private army, by the way, over there, because that's what the mafia do in Kyiv. Then a little while after that was in February, a little while after February, March, April, May was the advent of this fire at Odessa's trade union headquarters. Can you just say something about that before we hand over to Andrei to
talk
about
what was
it?
Happening is in Odessa, which is, it's got a fairly large Russian population and it was traditionally a Russian city. A lot of people weren't happy with the Maidan coup and they basically got a camp outside the trade union headquarters in Odessa. It was a sort of camp against the coup.
It was understandable for us that Ukrainian want to fight against our people. I mean the leftists, okay? And our people, especially young people, try to prepare to fight against them. But the main mistake was that Nazi, already came to kill. Our people came to fight. They were prepared to fight against. But fight by arms or legs or something like that. Nothing special. They came already killed to kill our people. And I have some friends, two friends, who was there in Odessa in a trade union building. And they say that there were many propositions to go away from this place. But one of my friends told me that, you see, it was something like a provocation. Because he told me that he never saw these guys. But they say, no, came into the building, tried to hide and tried to defend ourselves and so on. And you see, the Ukrainians said that 58 people were killed there. But many, many people said that something about 320 people were killed. Because Ukraine, they completely closed the building during the next day by, zabor. Big fence, no offense, how to say English. They built their walls around this building, which were burnt, and never stayed that. Nobody knows what they did behind these walls, you see? And especially for me, it was a most terrible thing that they, in a very cruel way, killed many people, never mind how many, 28 or 300, never mind. They burned people alive. And the whole world, look at this picture, and nobody said that we need to stop it. How is it possible? Okay.
Yeah, you're talking about the Nazis. I mean, you know, old Zelensky himself, he is Jewish. So how can he be running a country with Nazis in?
Tony, who told that to be Jewish, it's impossible to be Nazi?
Well, wasn't it Hitler?
You see, it's difficult for me to say why the Jewish guy who was never a politician came to president chair and decided to continue the war. If you became a leader, the main task for you to stop the war, to stop killing people. But you see now he refused against any conversation with the Russian Federation. So it is really so he decided to continue this war until the last Ukrainian will be killed. Okay.
So what about these Nazis? Are they real? Is there really Nazis there? I mean, this seems to be maybe just Russian propaganda.
You see, the Nazi and especially the unpunished Nazi, they never hide their nature. It's not difficult. Try to find in YouTube many clips of soldiers of Azov. Try to examine their tattoos. Their whole body in the Nazi symbols. What do you think? They just a game for them? No, it is their real faith for them. And the Ukrainian government and the government of the Western countries try to keep their eyes closed because it is very comfortable for them that somebody going to fight against Russia. I think that's all. But we know that they are real Nazi. We know it very well. And they never tried even to hide it.
Well, they don't, but the Western press does, Martin.
They do, although I heard at one stage that Western journalists were taking photographs of Ukrainian military personnel, and they were saying, can you please take off your swastikas, because we don't want people at home to see your swastika badges. And, of course, the Azov Battalion is a paramilitary right-wing force.
Well, what do our grandparents think if they could see this censorship?
Well, I mean, the world is full of manipulation, isn't it? There was a possibility. Zelensky was originally elected against Poroshenko because he said, we're going to have to make peace with the Russians. And that's why he won the election. He then went down to the Donbass to talk to Biletsky and the other neo-Nazi Azov people. And they basically said to him, if you try and make peace with the Russians, we're going to kill you. And at that point, Zelensky changed his mind.
Well, that's right. He talks about this in the longer interview, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk with Andriy Kocharov from the technical research, well, it wasn't research, was it? Trade union. I think if you speak Russian, you'll know exactly what he meant when he was talking about the name of the trade union. But anyway, the final clip with Andriy, like I say, final full version will be up on our show page later tonight. He talks about the 2017 assassination of Zakhachenko. So before we hear from him, Martin, who was Zakhachenko?
He was the elected prime minister of the Donetsk People's Republic. And he was killed by a bomb in his office, probably planted by the Ukrainian SBU with the support of British Special Forces MI6. So we paid to assassinate their prime. Don't forget there's supposedly a ceasefire. If they tried to assassinate
Minsk
Zelensky.
Minsk agreement, mate. Minsk
yes,
agreement.
That's right. Well, so there's a Minsk agreement, supposedly a ceasefire.
What the Minsk
while
agreement,
the ceasefire's on, they're actually assassinating the Prime
what
Minister.
What the Minsk agreement is for is just to try and con the other side, not to kill you.
Well, it's become clear, has it not, that the both Hollande and Merkel has come out and said, when we did the Minsk agreement with the Russians and the Belarusians and the Ukrainians, it was on the understanding that we were basically lying when we were preparing them to fight. So, and just look at what's actually happening now with the Ukrainian forces trying to fight their way into the Donbass. Who's invading who here? Who's invading who? The Russians are defending their territory.
Ukrainian use, their all bad kinds of war. For example, they killed one of the leaders of DPR, Alexander Zakharchenko. And you see, they never even tried to hide it. They always were proud. Yes, we killed him.
I mean, do we know how or who, how he was killed? Because this is, must be something which is well known in the Donbass. British people know nothing about this. So who killed him and how?
Okay, he has a habit, not far from his office. He often went to the one little restaurant with the name Separatist. And he go there for a dinner. And there is a small corridor between two doors. And when he came in this small corridor, something like 2 or 3 meters, the electricity lamp exposed above his head, and his body was damaged terribly.
Well, that's a neat trick, isn't it? So you walk just underneath a light bulb, and the light bulb's actually a bomb full of shrapnel, and it blows, doesn't quite blow your head off, but it causes enough injuries to kill you.
Yes, and of course he's the elected head of the Donetsk Republic. At the time, the Minsk agreements were supposedly in force. There's supposedly discussions about, there's supposed to be a ceasefire, although we now know that they had no intention of sticking to the ceasefire. And when the Russian military intervened in the Ukraine in 2022, the Donbass the republics were about to be invaded by the Ukrainian army. And they even say, we want to take back all the territory. Now, the Minsk agreement said you can't just take back all the territory, you've got to talk to the rebels. But of course they had no intention of talking to the rebels. They always wanted to take the territory back. There has been a possibility of peace at the beginning of the latest round of fighting, but who scotched that? Boris Johnson. He said, no, we're not having any peace here.
Well, thanks very much to Andrei Kocharov anyway. Maybe we'll be hearing again from him soon. He did say he knows some other people who speak pretty good English out in Lugansk. Well, it would be nice to have a kind of correspondent.
It's great to hear this side of the story, because we're just not hearing it.
Nothing about this at all.
I mean, you'd have thought that some journalists from the West would go and find out what the other side think. There are a few, I suppose, on YouTube, like that.
But they often get their passports withdrawn or whatever. They're getting bullied.
There's a German journalist who's been sentenced to prison in Germany if she comes home. Anyway, she's been reporting from the wrong side of the tracks.
Tonight on looking at the Nazi side. Thanks very much, Martin. You can probably shuffle off here. We've got another 6-7 minutes. You can listen to this one and comment on it if you want. But this is somebody who was brought to my attention by Jungle Bus Millie a couple of weeks ago, a guy called Matthias Ruth, and he's done an excellent book, actually. It's called The Nazi Roots of the Brussels EU. He's a German doctor who was very active during the pandemic in a positive fashion, but he'd written this book quite a long time before, and here he is explaining how the European Union actually, and he is as a German, it's interesting to hear him saying this, was actually planned by his very own Nazis from years before, and that's what created it in the first place.
The people of the world were told about history that there was World War One, and it just happened. Some kings or emperors at that time ended up in some rivalry, and suddenly there was war. Not so. This war was a war of conquest, organized, conceived, strategically planned by pharmaceutical and chemical cartel, namely Bayer, BASF, Hoechst, who at that time had the lead in identifying new molecules, reproducing them, patenting them, owning them, and they wanted to export this model to other countries. Now, these other countries, they didn't want to be controlled by them, so they needed to organize a military adventure, military conquest of these countries. And now we understand that World War I was nothing less than the first attempt of this new industry, the chemical, pharmaceutical concentration of power to claim the domination of Europe and the world. And then this adventure ended in a defeat, luckily, at the price of millions of people dying. And the German emperor was sent into the exile, and the corporate interest continued and invested in the Nazis. And Bayer, BASF, Hoechst, by that time they had formed the IG Farben cartel, that became the largest supporter of the Nazis' rise to power. And at the end of World War II, after the defeat, after 1945, there was even a specific trial where 24 managers of IG Farben were tried for the crimes they committed in Nuremberg. But that is just the backdrop of this book. What really triggered me to initiate this project was that we were able to find documents about the key architect of the Brussels EU. Unbeknown to most people, this was a gentleman by the name of Walter Hallstein. Walter Hallstein was a prominent lawyer in Nazi Germany. He was member of a delegation that was sent down by the Hitler regime to Rome to negotiate with the Mussolini lawyers about the future shape of Europe after they had conquered Europe. That was in June 1938, 1.5 years or 14 months before they started World War II. They knew they would do this. They knew they would launch this war. And they started to think, how are they going to administer this conquered countries? What are the laws, the administrative regulations? And Hallstein was the key person in that, in the German delegation, for the new architecture of a Nazi cartel Europe. Luckily, that didn't happen. And everyone thought that key people of that nature would actually go to prison or would be sentenced and removed from public office or, you know, put away. Not so with Mr. Hallstein. When he was interrogated by the what was called the denazification committee of the Allies, there were specific committees set up to make sure that the Nazis could not continue with their philosophy and when he was interviewed, he lied to them. He was they had to sign a document indicating whether they were members of Nazi organizations and were promoting that philosophy and stuff like that. And we got hold of that that document, and we saw that he was just outright lying. He was a member of the most notorious professional organization of the Nazis, which is was the Nazi Association of what they called protectors of the law. I mean, the Nazi law, you know. And he was a lead figure for the Nazi state in these negotiations. And he just lied. He just said, well, I'm innocent. And that was his entree into the next life. And he was picked up by the first German Chancellor Adenauer. And they and promoted to the position of the first office, promoted to the chief negotiator for preparing the Rome treaties, which became in 1957 the first legal foundation of the Brussels EU. And then he was promoted by the West German government to become the first president of the EU Commission. And he was given 8,000 and something bureaucrats,
people working
under him, only responsible to this one person, to create what we today know as the Brussels EU Europe, including the undemocratic structures the EU Commission was created as an exclusive executive committee responsible to literally no one. That's how it's phrased. Not the people, not the governments, to no one. They have the exclusive right to initiate legislation. Where are we? We're living in the 21st century and everyone thinks we are living in a democracy. It's outright dictatorship there on behalf of corporate interests.
Correct. Matthias Rath there, very interesting guy. His book, The Nazi Roots of the Brussels EU, is excellent. I would thoroughly recommend it. And it's almost written to be entertaining to read as well. Lots of illustrations, diagrams and that sort of thing. It's certainly not just a load of text. Maybe we'll be hearing more from him again at some point. I do hope so. Thanks very much to Jungle Bus Millie for bringing us to his attention. And also it's interesting, of course, to hear a German talking about his own countrymen creating a kind of Nazi Fourth Reich system in the European Union. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also, of course, to Andrei Kocharov, particularly, and Alex Craner, also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, as many people do, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page. You also find the podcast, full-length interview, story links, comment page, and key little thing is our email addresses. So if you want to send me something, you can do it on that page or just email me. Or you can do it on the Telegram channel, of course. You can subscribe to my... mind you, anyone that messes around on there doesn't last long. You can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. My paperbacks, firstly about deals with the Allies and the Nazis at the end of World War II, The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group, costs £15. Also my secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination, The Siege of Heaven Reader, both on eBay, and you'll find The Siege of Heaven ebook with all my articles, including this year's everything, really, pretty much, including the article I did about the English Civil War and witchcraft, particularly around Cromwell, the bankrupt brewer of Huntingdon, all via www.bilderberg.org. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream here, and over Sunday breakfast at camblesradioquk.com. Do please feel free to make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol, and on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. I'm off to the Resistance Festival at Monkton Wild, which is where a lot of people are actually part of trying to save another charity from a hostile takeover bid, where people from, is it PricewaterhouseCoopers or someone like that, trying to destroy a community and take it over. So do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show at talkradio.org.uk next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
How bright it's burning, Joseph, my time is come, the Son of God is yours.
Something wrong, but when I turned, he was gone.